I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Michael Linden from the Center for American Progress. Going to be talking about the big cuts that the GOP keeps talking about. What happens if we go and we slash and burn and we cut programs and we destroy the things that government does? What is that going to look like? I say it's wrong-headed and basically just stupid. And to be honest, I don't know that they actually believe what they say. Also, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale about the coalition rally that happened today in Harrisburg about the Marcellus shale drilling. And what we need is a sane extraction tax. Something to make sure that we can fund our roads and bridges that are going to be torn up by the machinery that comes in, by the trucks that are going back and forth, that we have the money to clean up the environmental mess that will inevitably be left. And since it is our gas, maybe as a society we should benefit from it. Maybe cheaper natural gas prices for seniors and low-income families, maybe a way to help our cities, maybe a way to help our citizens move ahead, fund school programs, education, health, all those things. I think it's a good start. And also we will be talking about the Frankenfish, the giant Frankenfish that they're screwing with Winona Hodder from the Water and Food Watch group. But before we get to all of that, I want to congratulate every working person in this country. Congratulations. We now have 400 billionaires on the Forbes 400. As Forbes.com reports, it's been a year of reclamation for America's richest. The total net worth of the Forbes 400 is up 8% to $1.37 trillion. Well outgaining the 1% rise of the S&P 500 index. That's over the last 12 months. More than half, 217 of our billionaire class, are richer than they were a year ago. So congratulations. We have helped the very wealthy get through this recession. It was tough on them. It really was. It was tough. You know, they had the strong arm politicians. You know, you gotta do all those things to get those tax cuts made permanent. Because after all, you know, they do have to buy the generic brand food at the store. You know, they're having a tough time. They can't afford the name brand stuff. So, our help is going to make their lives a little bit easier, a little bit more tolerable. You know, because heaven forbid that they have to go grocery shopping for themselves. And not pay one of us to do it. The headline numbers tell only part of the story, according to Forbes. 45% of the 400 failed to add to their fortunes. Aw, I feel for them. I wonder how many of them are homeless. I wonder how many of the Forbes 400 from 2008 and 2009 now find themselves homeless. I wonder how many of their homes were foreclosed upon. I wonder how many jobs they lost. I wonder, you know, our captains of industry, our titans of technology, the very wealthy in this country, I wonder how much they really suffered. I mean, you know, because not being able to buy that third or fourth yacht, you know, when you go to the yacht club, it can be pretty embarrassing, I think. I don't really know because I don't have just one yacht yet, and I don't really plan on ever having one. But, you know, I can only imagine. I can only imagine that it's very difficult on them. And if you remember, in 2008, the record for the Forbes 400 was $1.57 trillion. So, you know, they're about $200 billion behind the time. So we need to help them. So you know what? We got to call the president and say, you know what, President Obama? Get off of that. In fact, repeal all the tax cuts for the bottom 97%. Repeal those. Give them up to the people at the top. They need it. We really need to get back to that $1.57 trillion net worth for our top 400 citizens. We do. We absolutely have to get there. So that, I'm not quite sure why, but I feel some pride. I'm proud of our nation. I'm proud of the fact that we have 400 people who control the same amount of wealth as about half of the population in this country. I'm really happy to see that we have a group of people that you could probably fit into a large size room controlling the wealth of half the nation. I'm proud of that. It gives me some good feelings in my gut. Doesn't it you? I mean, don't you feel good to know that we've got 400 people worth $1.37 trillion at a time when people are losing their homes, people are losing their jobs, they're losing their health care, they're having to stand in line waiting at food banks so that they can feed their children? Aren't you happy to hear that we've got a billionaire class that is thriving and growing? I know I am on some level. Let's look at the top. Let's look at some of the list. Of course, our friend Bill Gates, number one with $54 billion of personal wealth. He also owns $4 billion worth of stock in Microsoft. Warren Buffett was number two, of course, $45 billion. He made his money with Berkshire Hathaway. Again, he has $5 billion in stock in that. Lawrence Ellison of Oracle has $27 billion. And then there's Christy Walton, the smart Walton girl, because she's number four. She has $24 billion and $2.5 billion in Walmart stock. And then the very conservative Koch brothers, you know, the ones who are funding the Americans for Prosperity groups and all the right-wing group, Tea Party groups who are out there going, smaller government, less spending, smaller government, less spending. And the Koch brothers combined have about, over $50 billion between them. So I think they can fund a spell check for some of the misspelled signs. What do you think? We should make a petition to Charles and David Koch, so that we can get some really good high glossy signs. At least it would put people back to work. Makes sense to me. Then there are the dumber Waltons. There's Jim and Alice and S. Robson. Each of them have about $20 billion, 7, 8, and 9. And then, of course, Michael Bloomberg rounds out the top 10 with $18 billion. So, you know, $109 million to buy an election, that's a drop in the bucket for a guy with $18 billion. So those are your top 10. We should be very proud of them. Four of them were actually self-made. You know, kind of Horatio, I guess Warren Buffett would be the only real Horatio Alger story, came out of poverty. But the Waltons inherited, the Koches inherited. In fact, I actually wonder how many of the people on the Forbes 400 were birth lottery winners. And I did a real quick, just a real quick cursory survey of the top, and I came across, you know, a couple birth lottery winners that I thought were interesting. The Pritzker family, Hyatt Hotels, 11 of them are on the billionaires list. 11 of them inherited their wealth. The Cargills, there are 8 of them from Cargill industry, birth lottery winners. So congratulations for you. Gold ticket. The Johnsons from SC Johnson, you know, the people who make the car wax and all the, you know, all the products that we see on the stores that are now most, a lot of being made in China. There are 5 of those. The Hearst people, you know, the people with the newspaper, long, long, long time ago. 5 of those. You got the 4 Waltons who, you know, have been sticking it to us ever since. 3 Mars. I like candy. Candy bars are not bad. Again, birth lottery winners. In fact, the Mars family, pretty interesting. They're one of those group, one of those families that have been heavily funding the repeal of the estate tax. And, well, for obvious reason. I mean, I would guess pretty much everybody on our birth lottery list would be in favor of doing away with the estate tax because, you know, they got their money the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. And then there were the 3 Koch brothers, the 2 crazy ones. Maybe I shouldn't say that. The 2 very, very conservative T-Twizzler ones. They're out there. And then I guess they have a normal brother who doesn't talk to them but still made a lot of money off the gas from Kansas. So, again, congratulations, every one of you. I know we sacrificed this year. And I know that we had an opportunity. I think next year we can do better. So I'm proposing that we go and we ask the president, do away with the tax cuts for us working stiffs. We really don't need to eat. You know, what we can do is we can have group hugs in the wintertime to stay warm. I'm in favor of that. So big group hugs, stay warm. We can take the money that we save from heating our homes and push it right up to the top because maybe next year, we can come back here and be very proud to know that we've got 400 of the wealthiest people, and maybe we can get them back to that $1.57 trillion number. Because remember, they need your money. I mean, isn't that what the Republicans keep telling us? That we have to extend those tax cuts because, you know, the wealthy, they need the money. And you got people like Michelle Bachmann saying there are no more rich people left. All the rich people are gone. All the rich people are gone. All they're gone. I want to get to my favorite billionaire because, you know, like athletes, I have a favorite billionaire. And my favorite billionaire is number 308. He's number 655 in the world, but 308 here in the U.S. In fact, I'm thinking about getting a shirt that has I love 308. His name is Stephen Schatz Biscotti. Stephen is worth $1.3 billion. So maybe next year we can get you back up to 1.4 where you were last year. But he made his money the old-fashioned way. He didn't inherit it. He actually worked for it. Self-made man. That's what I love about him. But Schatz made his money outsourcing jobs. That was Schatz's job. He started an outsourcing business. And you could send those jobs away and say goodbye, high wages. You know, if I owned a business, I would go to Schatz and say, you know, I got these jobs. Can you ship them somewhere, get them done a lot cheaper? Because after all, you know, I don't give a rat's behind about America. But that's basically what outsourcing will do for you. We got about 2 minutes here before the break. I want to get to the phone call here if I ever get to it. We got Jim on line 1. How are we doing today, Jim?
Just fine, Rick. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
You know, 400 is a magic number. Number one, in New York, there was a 400 society because there were only 400 people who could fit in Mrs. Astor's ballroom. And in the South, before the Civil War, only 400 families owned slaves. So go figure.
Wow. I thank you for that. I did not realize that. And now we've got 400 billionaires who, you know, thanks to our hard work, can now be proud of the fact that everyone on the list is a billionaire.
Well, just thought I'd share.
Thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate it. Again, I'm very proud of the fact that we have these billionaires. And you should be too. So you should give yourself a pat on the back for a job well done. Well done. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Michael Linden from the Center for American Progress. Stick around. We're right back after this.
not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans attended a welcome back ceremony for auto workers in Tennessee, but there wasn't much rejoicing. Jesse Russell reports.
Tennessee Republican Bob Corker wasn't greeted with much enthusiasm during a ceremony welcoming workers back to a Spring Hill, Tennessee auto manufacturing plant. Corker joined two other Republican lawmakers for the ceremony, which saw General Motors welcoming 483 workers back to the plant. According to online auto magazine Jalopnik, Corker was booed when he claimed to have contributed to helping strengthen the auto industry in the country. Corker, along with the two other Republicans in attendance, Senator Lamar Alexander and Representative Marsha Blackburn, all opposed the Obama administration's successful auto industry bailout bid. In March of 2009, Corker called the move a major power grab. Alexander said in March of 2009 that the bailout was a move in the wrong direction, and Blackburn said in December of 2008 that Obama's plan wouldn't make the industry more successful or efficient. According to Jalopnik, an official from the UAW made it clear auto workers will remember at election time the politicians that refused to help the ailing auto industry.
New York City's largest public employee union, AFSCME's DC-37, says a restructuring plan for Health and Hospitals Corp. is a slash-and-burn plan with a deeply flawed cost-benefit analysis that undermines public health care. DC-37 President Lillian Roberts says the plan will hurt hundreds of thousands of people without health insurance who depend on HHC for health care.
It's going to suffer because of it, because we expect the patient population has been increasing by large numbers, and we know that it will increase more.
The union says the restructuring plan is misguided in proposing to eliminate 3,700 full-time equivalent employees who deliver these vital services to communities in New York City.
If you're going to contract out anything, it has to be contracted out, and the person's expected to make profit. We all pay for that, and I think it's disgusting because that is a demand service, and we're not talking about cans of peas. We're talking about human beings.
Nearly half of the more than 2.2 million unemployed workers who are 55 years of age or older have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. That's according to data from the Labor Department. That's a record number and is more than double what it was at the start of the recession. Census numbers released last week show that the poverty rate in that age group is growing. 9.4% of those between 55 and 64 were living in poverty in 2009.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party, lights and rollers too. We'll serve the finest tea and fancy cookies too. Let's go through the neighborhood inviting everyone. Let's have a tea party, won't it be fun?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, every day I keep hearing Republicans saying what we need to do is cut spending, cut taxes, cut government. Is that the way we really want to go? Do we really want to kick granny to the curb, or are there alternatives? Michael Linden is Associate Director for Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. He's written a piece called 1,000 Cuts. You can see that at our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. There's a link right there. Michael Linden, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I'm reading through your report, and I'm going, all I'm hearing from Republicans are cuts, pain, and more pain. There's got to be an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, the conservatives, they like to say that the budget problem is a spending problem, but they never seem to indicate what exactly they'd cut, except for some vague promises to find that ever-elusive waste, fraud, and abuse, which just doesn't get you there. So we wrote this report to try and show what would cuts needed to balance the budget actually look like, and it's pretty painful. It's pretty terrible, actually.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we've got candidates in this state. One's running for governor who says, well, we need to cut spending, but he can't find one thing that he would cut. We've got a guy running for Senate, Pat Toomey, who said this economy, if he were in charge, we would have had a harder down. Can you explain what a harder down would look like?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough thing to say to people who are still out of work after 2 years. I mean, it doesn't get much harder than that. You know, I just people who say we can cut spending, and they say it in the abstract, they aren't being honest. They aren't really dealing with the true issue, which is that a lot of what government does, in fact, most of what government does, is popular, beneficial, and necessary. And it's not so easy to find the things that are wasteful or unpopular. If those things really were that easy to find, they'd already been cut already.
Right. But what they do is, and really the conservatives do a masterful job of it, is they make our government budget look, they try and make it look like our kitchen table budget. Well, if you know, if I don't have enough money this week, I'm going to cut out cable TV. Or if I don't have, you know, enough income this week, we're going to have mac and cheese instead of, you know, steak. But government budgets aren't that simple.
No, they're not. And you know, there are some things in the government budgets that are like, you know, mac and cheese and the day-to-day expenses. But there's also a lot of things in the budget that are investments for our long-term security, safety, and prosperity. And sure, we could cut those out and balance the budget that way, but we're going to end up being a poorer, sicker country for it.
With a broken-down infrastructure and
right.
A place where if you want to attract business, if that's your goal, you really can't because there's no infrastructure.
Right. Right, exactly. Sure, we could stop building roads, and we could stop investing in schools, and we could stop scientific and health research. That would all save money, but at the end of the day, we're going to be worse off.
Well, let's get back to your report. Tell me about this 1,000 cuts report you guys put out.
Sure. So what we did was we tried to do a good faith effort. We said, okay, in 2015, which is the target year for the President's Fiscal Commission, what is it going to take to get the budget into primary balance, which is to say that all government spending, with the exception of interest payments on the debt, are equal to government revenue? In other words, when the government's paying for everything, all of its day-to-day activities. And that would be about $255 billion in deficit reduction. That's the gap in 2015. And what we tried to do was find $255 billion of spending cuts for the federal budget for that year. And we tried to do it in, like I said, a good faith way. We didn't try to pick the ones that would scare people or shock people. We said, okay, if we had to do it, how would we do it? And even then, there just isn't that much fat in the federal budget to cut. So we ended up cutting things that we wouldn't really want to cut, like highway funding and health research and infrastructure investments and education. You know, we tried to do our best to protect the most vulnerable, to protect important investments. But $255 billion, that's a lot of money to cut out of the federal budget, and it's not easy to do.
Well, what the conservatives would say is, well, we will cut those programs, and those people who are affected, well, they're just going to have to get over it.
Yeah, but, you know, what's funny about this is that the conservatives, they won't identify the cuts that they're making. We said, here's what we would do. We don't think we should do it that way, but here's what we would do if we had to. Now it's your turn, and I'd really like to see some conservatives step up to the plate and say, you know, well, I don't want to cut this, but I'd cut this instead. And they don't do that. So, you know, they're not serious about cutting the deficit. They're serious about cutting taxes for rich people. They're dead serious about that, but they are not serious about cutting the deficit.
Well, they're in favor of cutting the taxes for the very wealthy, but they're not telling us how they're going to pay for that.
Right.
Other than taking it out of school lunch programs. And maybe I'm playing into that as well, where I'm scaring people, but that's where this money comes from. It goes down to the people who can least afford it. So what we've got is a society where we're putting the burden on those least able to shoulder the burden.
Yeah, that's right. We're asking the middle class and the working class to pick up more and more of the burden, and we're asking the very wealthiest people to pick up less of it. And that just doesn't seem like a recipe for long-term shared growth and shared prosperity.
Not at all. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Michael Linden. He's the Associate Director for Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. His piece is 1,000 cuts. You can get to the link at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Michael, you know, give me one example of something that you would cut Maybe we can give Tom Corbett an idea when he goes on his tours of how he's going to slash government and how we're going to balance the budget here without giving one example. Can you give me an example of something that you guys have identified that that you would cut?
Yeah, sure. So I'll give you a good example. Now, this is at the federal level. It's different, obviously, at, the state level. But, you know, the federal government spends about $15 billion a year on agriculture subsidies. This is basically federal taxpayer, U.S. taxpayers subsidizing very wealthy farmers. These are not family farms. These are not little, you know, plots of land. These are huge companies that are basically more profitable because of federal taxpayer dollars. We could cut some of the least efficient ones out and save at least half that amount of money. I'll give you another example. We spend we are now spending more than $100 billion more in real terms on defense, on the Pentagon, than we were at the height of the Reagan buildup in the 80s. So we're spending $100 billion more than we were at the height of the Cold War. Now, we've got to be able to save some money there.
I agree. The Pentagon budget is, you know, it's one of those things that nobody's willing to, on either side of the aisle, I mean, it's almost sacrosanct.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of voices out there who are saying, yeah, we do need to get a handle on it. Look, Secretary Gates is one of those voices, to his credit, saying we just can't continue to spend this kind of money on defense, so we're going to have to find some savings there. And Senator Coburn, you know, I don't agree with him a lot of the time, but he's on board on this. So there are some voices out there saying being reasonable about this particular issue.
Well, you know, here's the thing. We wouldn't be, I don't think we would be having this discussion about what we should be cutting and what programs should be cut and who should be feeling the pain if we weren't involved in this misadventure in the Middle East. We've got money for war. We've got money for making big rocks, little rocks. But we don't have money for health care for our citizens. We don't have money for programs to help feed the poor or take care of the elderly. For some reason, we just don't have the money for that. But making big rocks into smaller rocks, we've got tons of money for that.
Yeah, the wars really did put us in a bit of a hole. I mean, there's no question about it. We spent about $1 trillion fighting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, none of which was paid for. I mean, this has been said a million times, but it's worth saying at least one more time. When we went to war in Iraq, that was the first time in American history that we went to war without also increasing taxes to pay for it.
We actually cut taxes.
It's ahistorical. It's just never happened before.
And it's mind-boggling that you see these people marching in the streets with their misspelled signs and their illogical slogans about smaller government, less taxes, but you never heard a peep out of them. During the years when Bush was in office, or when Reagan was in office, for that matter.
Right. Look, there might be some legitimate concern out there over deficits. I'm concerned about the deficit.
Me too.
Let's direct our ire at the people who are responsible. Don't forget that when President Bush took over in 2001, the Congressional Budget Office was projecting surpluses for as far as the eye could see. And he handed President Obama a $1.2 trillion deficit. So, yeah, we can be upset about deficits, but let's direct our ire at the right people.
I'm right. You couldn't have said that any better, in my opinion. And let's get back to this for a second, because I do want to focus on a couple more of the cut ideas that you had. Because I think people need to understand that if we follow the Republican logic, which is basically slash and burn, what the world's going to look like in 2 or 3 or 4 years. So
right.
What else did you guys come up with?
So there are some things, as I mentioned earlier, that we would be willing to cut. And then there's some things that, you know, we only cut because we had to hit that 255 target. So, for example, we reduced federal highway funding by 40%. That's a huge cut. I mean, that would really take a big bite out of new construction, out of maintenance, out of adding new lanes. And, you know, look, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I know that Pennsylvania could use a little bit of highway funding.
Think?
That's not an area that we should be cutting back on, but if we have to cut $255 billion from the budget, something's got to go. So that's one thing that we targeted reluctantly. We targeted Pell Grants, again, reluctantly, but if we have to save that money and we want to, you know, not cut food stamps, which we really don't want to do, then that's something we had to go after a little bit. So these are the kind of things where you have to start making hard choices. And the point of the paper was to illustrate those hard choices. And that is what conservatives just refuse to do. It's easy to say cut the budget. It's much harder to say what you'd actually cut.
Well, it's easy to look at some mythical giant that needs to be slain. And, you know, you listen to the Grover Norquists of the world. We want to drag it in, the beast into the bathtub and drown it. That makes for nice sloganeering. But the reality is when you start drowning these programs, that means real people are affected and real people are harmed.
That's right. When you talk about cuts in the abstract, it sounds good, but the effect is not abstract. The effect is very real. But, you know, here's what I'm going to get at. I'm calling conservatives bluff on this. I don't think they actually want to cut spending. And all the evidence is on my side on this. They were in power for 8 years and they didn't cut spending. They don't want to cut spending. They don't care about deficits. They just care about cutting taxes for very wealthy people. That's what they care about.
Yep.
And if pretending that the government is too big will help them get there, they'll do it.
Well, I think Dick Cheney said it best. Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. That was their mentality.
Right, right. That's their main goal is cutting taxes for wealthy people. At least it seems to be that's where all the evidence is. But if I'm wrong, I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear a conservative get on this show and explain to you exactly what $255 billion they would cut from the budget. No gimmicks, no games, no magic. Just tell us what it would cost. And we haven't heard that yet. And I don't think we should take them seriously.
I would absolutely welcome it. But let me ask you this. Let's say that the Pat Toomeys of the world had their choice and they lived up to their word and said, you know what, we're going to cut it out and it's going to hurt. Who would be hurt? Who do you think would be affected the most?
Well, yeah, if you take them at their word and you say, they say we want to cut all this money out of the budget and we don't want to cut defense and we don't want to cut, all the corporate subsidies that are in the tax code, which they don't want to do, and they don't want to cut, various other sacred cows, which I don't want to cut either, like veterans' health and things like that. We don't want to touch those. Well, who's going to get hurt? Well, that's education. That's health care. That's investments in infrastructure, and those are the things that are left on the table. And if they don't want to cut those either, then there's nothing left on the table.
So basically what you're saying is conservative world would be a bunch of dumb people who can't get to a hospital that doesn't exist.
Well, I guess they'd say, let the private sector do it. I mean, I guess that's their argument. I don't want to speak for them, but I suppose. I guess what I'm saying is I don't really believe them. I don't believe that they would actually cut these things because they're popular. Because they work. I mean, Medicare is the most successful healthcare program in the country. Social Security, incredibly popular, incredibly successful. If you look at senior citizen poverty rates after we instituted Medicare and after we, you know, made Social Security more robust, they plummeted. They plummeted from the highest demographic, from the demographic with the highest poverty to the one with the lowest poverty. That's success right there.
I agree.
So we don't want to cut those things. And I don't think conservatives will do that either. So I think they're just demagoguing.
And that's a good place to end this because I agree with you. I think it's all just a bunch of smoke and mirrors. And because when they're pushed, they never come up with anything.
Right.
Again, the paper is 1,000 Cuts. Michael Linden, Associate Director for Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is the website. Also, you can get to that piece at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Michael, always great to talk to you. I appreciate your time and look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thanks so much.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Here's today's number, 93.4. That's $93.4 million, the amount that BP has now admitted to spending in just 4 months on its national advertising blitz, which is intended to put some gloss on its badly faded corporate image. Unless you've been under a big rock since BP's Gulf Oil blowout in April, it's been practically impossible to avoid the giant's self-serving ads, which constantly blare from TVs and holler at us from the pages of all major city newspapers. This unprecedented PR campaign is run under a slogan proclaiming, "We will make this right." Each ad praises the British corporation's efforts in the Gulf region to clean up the mess, restore the ecology, and compensate the businesses and workers who've been suffering devastating losses. Heretofore, BP adamantly refused to disclose how much PR money it's been throwing into this puff and buff job, but Representative Kathy Castor of Florida, who serves on the House Energy Committee, demanded an accounting on behalf of the hard-hit folks in her district. "Every day you get up and see these full-page ads in every newspaper and the TV ads," she says, adding that it's really ticking people off. They're even more ticked off now that BP has admitted to spending more than $5 million a week on its window dressing effort. Its total ad expenditure for the 4 months came to $5 million more than it granted to four Gulf Coast states to help revive their decimated tourist industry. Worse, BP proceeded to insult the intelligence of the area's people by claiming that this huge ad outlay was necessary, quote, "to keep coastal residents informed." This is Jim Hightower saying, come on. BP has done all it can to deceive the people. Telling such blatant fibs as that is as useless as putting lipstick on a hog. It can't hide the ugliness that is BP.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, I often wonder why we don't get fired up. Why is it when we see this massive accumulation of wealth into the hands of such a small number of people that we don't get upset? Where are the Tea Party? Where are these folks with their misspelled signs and illogical slogans? Where are they? Well, what they're out there doing is they're out there promoting more concentration of wealth. We want the billionaire class to get larger at the expense of the rest of us. And I would argue that during the Reagan years, when we completely began destroying the tax code and began the assault on working people, that was a massive redistribution of wealth that created this billionaire class. It's pretty simple. Jim writes me, and again, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails. Jim writes, Gore Vidal had it right years ago. There's only one party in America, the property party, with one end being Democrats and the other end being Republicans. And, you know, there's an awful lot of truth to that. Ron writes me, Rick, you've been pronouncing the Koch brothers' name like former mayor of New York. This is incorrect. I was saying Koch. He's saying it's Koch. K-O-C-H is pronounced like the soft drink, he says. Coke, sort of like David Boner, is Boehner is pronounced Boehner, as he spells out. Just thought you'd like to know. I appreciate that, Ron. Thanks so much. Again, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com if you've got any thoughts, comments, questions. But if you want to give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Is the number if you've got something on your mind, question, comment, or just something that's gotten under your skin. I'll tell you what's gotten under my skin. Christine O'Donnell is under my skin. The Republican senatorial candidate from Delaware used more than $20,000 in campaign funds to pay her rent and other personal expenses, according to a complaint filed Monday with the Federal Elections Commission. You'll remember on this program we talked with Melanie Sloan from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. They are a nonpartisan watchdog group. But what they're saying is, look, here's a woman who's, you know, good Christian conservative activist, good Christian conservative woman, out there preaching the good word, but she's never really had a steady job. So how is it you make it to 41 years old? How is it that you have a house and clothes and food and all the things that the rest of us get up every day and go to work for, yet you haven't had a job? You know, like they said, show me the money. Where did the money come from? Well, we know where the money came from. She has been a perpetual candidate. She's been one of these people who every cycle, she jumps into the race to get her name in there and, you know, do a little marketing business because that's her gig. Takes that money, pays her rent with it. And O'Donnell dismissed the allegations, saying that they were the work of opponents trying to derail her campaign. She said the momentum surrounding this campaign is obvious. That's why they're creating baseless accusations to try and stop it. I'm confident that we've been ethical, O'Donnell said. We have not. I personally have not misused campaign funds. We have our FEC lawyer, a great attorney, answering those charges if it ever goes anywhere. And, of course, their attack dog is a guy named Cleta Mitchell. And Cleta says that O'Donnell's campaign has not been served with any complaints, even though that there's something posted on the Crew website. She says, quote, these are outlandish allegations. Describing Crew as a left-wing front group funded by liberal financier George Soros. That seems to be the right-wing response to anything that they don't like. Well, Soros did it! You know, it's kind of like, you know, the white guy who got mugged, or the white woman who drowned her kids, or the black guy did it. You know, that's the conservative version of that. It's Soros did it. He funded it. And any attack, well, in this case, what seems to be true, any rational argument now is going to be pointed off as, well, Soros paid for it, and it's the left. Look, I love Crew because they are nonpartisan. They go after everybody. If you're a crook, they're coming after you. There are a number of Democrats on their list of crooked politicians. And what Cleta had to say, she said, if Melanie Sloan wants to deny that, you tell Melanie Sloan to reveal her donors. She's not neutral or arbitrator of ethics. I think she is. And when we had Melanie Sloan on this program, she was as a matter of fact as you could possibly be. These are the facts. And the facts are that this woman, Christine O'Donnell, made $5,800 in a year. She gave herself over $3,000 to her campaign. Which means for food, electricity, phones, gasoline for her car, repairs to her car, a car payment perhaps, clothes to put on her back, nails to be done, hair to be combed, all of that stuff, somehow she existed on just over $2,700 for an entire year. That, my friends, is not possible. So where'd she get the money? Well, in a March interview with the News Journal of Wilmington, a Delaware newspaper, O'Donnell acknowledged using campaign funds to pay half her rent at her current townhome and said it was legal because her house was a dual-purpose house. because it was her campaign headquarters too. And as I've said, maybe that'll fly because I think she's just been a perpetual candidate because that's her job. You know, people send her money and she's just a perpetual candidate. O'Donnell essentially used her campaign's bank card as her personal ATM, crew executive director Melanie Sloan said, and the improper spending likely would have gone on if not for her surprise victory in last week's primary. And I agree with that. I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are doing some shady things. She's now just in the spotlight. And look, when you step into the spotlight, when you're in that fishbowl, everybody's watching you. Everybody's paying attention. And everything you've ever done is going to come out. Every stupid thing you've ever said is going to pop up. Sloan said she never thought anybody would look close at her campaign finances because she was not considered a serious candidate. She thought she could get away with this. Now we're talking about a candidate for U.S. Senate. This is pretty serious, and there's no reason that Miss O'Donnell shouldn't have to follow the same rules as everybody else. Beside the FEC complaint, crew has sent a letter to Delaware U.S. Attorney David C. Weiss asking for a criminal investigation, and I think there should be. I think there should be people looking into this. And the reality is you look at this, a lot of shady stuff, and the question is this somebody we want in the U.S. Senate? Do we want this kind of a shady dealer, this kind of a, I'm going to say it, gold digger in the Senate? I don't. And I don't, and obviously the people of Delaware don't because she's down 15 points. I'm hoping that we're going to see, like we saw in New York when the Wall Street trader went up against, Carol Maloney up there, an 80-20 defeat. I hope the people of Delaware send a strong message that, hey, crazy is not electable. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Free labor, what exactly does that mean? Perhaps if a person would like, that person could work anywhere and be compensated an agreeable wage. This was the prevailing notion in the early 19th century where journeymen were free to make deals with their masters. It was very common in the northern part of the country and eventually wended its way to the south, where it was perceived as an attack on slavery. However, over time it became rooted throughout the country. It also became the source, in a convoluted sense, of the current relationship between work and management. The theory being that free labor mutated into a defense of individual wage bargaining. Employers capitalized on the concept that nothing could be more American and thus democratic as a man or a woman who could negotiate his or her own employment. The majority of workers suffered under this arrangement and provoked a lasting antagonism between labor and management that resulted in vicious attacks on collective bargaining, the perpetuation of scab labor, and relentless decertification votes. And its evolution in divisiveness and treachery is apparent in organizations such as Right to Work, an oxymoron for people bent on distorting the true meaning of democracy in the workplace. As we transition into a new presidential cycle, Right to Work and other groups with innocuous names as Workforce Family Institute and the Coalition for a Democratic Workforce are in place to offer up their brand of poison to anyone who thinks they can go it alone in the workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provided for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Lieutenant Governor candidate, on the Republican side, this Jim Cawley, who I don't think many people know. He's come out in favor of making Pennsylvania a right-to-work-for-less state. And, I mean, he was probably hijacked by these tea-twizzlers at this Altoona First Festival in Blair County. But, look, at the end of the day, this is the first major political person in the state of Pennsylvania to openly say this. Now, listen, working people, understand, right-to-work laws are right-to-work-for-less laws. They are designed to destroy working conditions and break down contracts. That's what they are here for. And look, you may not be thrilled with what's going on with the Democratic Party, but I'll tell you right now, they are not the ones out there pushing right to work for less legislation. They're not the ones out there pushing the end to project labor agreements that are smart policy that makes sure that large projects get done on time. They're not the ones out there doing that. They're not the ones out there saying we need to do away with Davis-Bacon prevailing wage protections. They're not the ones saying that. Because remember, and think about this for a second, what the Republicans are telling you is that we should be able to find the cheapest labor possible. That means if we can import people from overseas or from Russia or from Mexico, pay them a buck an hour, we should be able to do that. Because if we let them get away with these protections, these very modest protections, next are the minimum wage and the maximum hour laws. Remember, this stuff people fought, bled, and died for. You go back to the Lochner era at the turn of the 19th century here, 1905, 1910. They used the Bake Shop Act, and it's a really long story. Maybe I got a minute to get into it. New York passed a law saying you can't have people working in a bake shop longer than 60 hours. It was a health thing. And they wanted to make sure that people had jobs and people had family lives. So this one guy says, no, I'm not going to do it. We're going to work my employees 70, 80 hours a week because of liberty of contract. You know, they did it because they wanted to. They wanted to work 100 hours a week. Never mind the fact that if they left after 70 or 80 hours, I would fire them. You know, never mind that. We'll talk about that. But the Supreme Court of this country shot down the Bake Shop Act and held that Lochner was okay. Go ahead, buddy. Liberty of contract. Work people to the death. Work them to death if they want. Because after all, they made the choice to do it. Remember, you have the right to do that. And we're going back to that mentality where they want to do away with maximum hour laws, and they want to do away with minimum wage laws, and they want to do away with safety protections. Because, of course, you know, the benevolent corporation is always going to do what's in their best interest. Never mind the fact that their best interest is profit. And that means if you as a cog in the wheel get hurt, we can throw you off to the curb. That means as you as a cog in the wheel, if I can get somebody to do it cheaper, I'm going to do that. And that may be great for the individual business, but as a society, we cannot build a prosperous middle class on those policies. It's just not possible. And you got this guy walking from York to Washington, D.C. to, I'm against project labor agreements. Even though every study that you'll see says that project labor agreements save money, they get projects done on time, they're good for local communities because why? Well, people have reasonable living wages. And that money goes back into the community and reverberates through small businesses in the community. But never mind all that. All I care about is me here right now. Hooray for me and the heck with you. And that's the mentality that's been pushed in this country for far too long. Because it's short-sighted and it's stupid. And the short-sighted part is, today I save a penny. But it's going to cost me a dollar down the road. You know, we've got this mentality, and I've often said, in this country, we would step over a dollar to pick up a dime. Just so we could screw somebody out of something. And it's frustrating on a number of levels. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking with Andy Gussert. He's the National Director of Citizens for Trade Campaign, of Citizens Trade Campaign. Today they released a press release. Here's part of it. In a letter released today, 555 national, state, and local organizations from across the country representing more than 20 million combined members stood united in opposition to the Bush-negotiated trade agreements between Korea and the United States, vowing, quote, if it is brought before Congress without the needed changes, we will work to defeat it. Gussert says, as we struggle to lower unemployment in this country, the prospect of bringing up another job-killing trade deal before Congress is unfathomable. Unfathomable. Candidates across the country are running against the status quo trade model and are winning elections. Voters spoke loudly in 2006 and 8, and they do not support failed NAFTA experiment. Look, you know, we've had this conversation a number of times, and tomorrow when we talk to Andy Gussert, we'll go get into a little bit more of this. But the way out of this mess, the way out of our economic problems is by keeping jobs here, by putting people back to work, domestic consumption, domestic production. You know, when you go into the Walmarts, you look at the top, of the Forbes 400, four of the Walmart sisters, or brothers, you know, there's a couple of them. It doesn't matter. The four Walmarts, $20 billion apiece in wealth. Where'd they get that wealth from? Well, they snatched it from their employees. Where else? You know, I think of my grandmother, and I've talked about this before. My grandmother made $8 an hour in 1985. $8 an hour in 1985. We're talking 25 years ago. She had 6 weeks vacation. She had full health and dental. She had paid sick time, paid personal time. Because her union fought for those things. And the company was very profitable. They were a small company. They were profitable. And in comes the behemoth, in comes the giant, and killed everybody. Not just the one little store that my grandmother worked out, but the whole chain of small stores like that. And the reality is here we are 25 years later. Those workers aren't making much more than $8 an hour now, and they're not getting health benefits, they're not getting pensions, they're not getting vacation time like that. They're not getting sick in personal time. So where is that profit going? Well, we know where the profit's going. It's going into the hands of the four Walmart heirs. You know, the people who got their money the old-fashioned way. They inherited it. There's something wrong with this model, folks. Something desperately wrong. And until you and I stand together shoulder to shoulder, either in the street or on the shoproom floor, until we come together and demand an economy that works, that has health care, that has old age security, until we can get those things, we will be continually at each other's throat and desperate. And if we're desperate, we are easily manipulated by the Forbes 400. Think about that for a minute. Think about the reality. If you're worried about putting food on the table for your children, if you're worried about, hey, I might not be able to pay my mortgage next month, if you're worried about, oh my goodness, the light bill's due and I don't have the money, the credit card bill just came and up went my rate, even though I've never been late with a payment. If that happens, who do you turn to? Do you turn to the Forbes 400? Do you think they're going to help you out? Look what they've been doing to the president. This financial bill, this financial reform bill that benefits us on a number of levels. And look, I'm not thrilled with it. It should have been a lot stronger. A lot stronger. But you know, with these people, it ain't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale. Right back.
Scott Right Wing, Just Race, The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans attended a welcome back ceremony for auto workers in Tennessee, but there wasn't much rejoicing. Jesse Russell reports.
Tennessee Republican Bob Corker wasn't greeted with much enthusiasm during a ceremony welcoming workers back to a Spring Hill, Tennessee auto manufacturing plant. Corker joined two other Republican lawmakers for the ceremony, which saw General Motors welcoming 483 workers back to the plant. According to online auto magazine Jalopnik, Corker was booed when he claimed to have contributed to helping strengthen the auto industry in the country. Corker, along with the two other Republicans in attendance, Senator Lamar Alexander and Representative Marsha Blackburn, all opposed the Obama administration's successful auto industry bailout bid. In March of 2009, Corker called the move a major power grab. Alexander said in March of 2009 that the bailout was a move in the wrong direction, and Blackburn said in December of 2008 that Obama's plan wouldn't make the industry more successful or efficient. According to Jalopnik, an official from the UAW made it clear auto workers will remember at election time the politicians that refused to help the ailing auto industry.
New York City's largest public employee union, AFSCME's DC-37, says a restructuring plan for Health and Hospitals Corp. is a slash-and-burn plan with a deeply flawed cost-benefit analysis that undermines public health care. DC-37 President Lillian Roberts says the plan will hurt hundreds of thousands of people without health insurance who depend on HHC for health care.
It's going to suffer because of it, because we expect the patient population has been increasing by large numbers, and we know that it will increase more.
The union says the restructuring plan is misguided in proposing to eliminate 3,700 full-time equivalent employees who deliver these vital services to communities in New York City.
If you're going to contract out anything, it has to be contracted out, and the person's expected to make profit. We all pay for that, and I think it's disgusting because that is a demand service. We're not talking about cans of peas. We're talking about human beings.
Nearly half of the more than 2.2 million unemployed workers who are 55 years of age or older have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. That's according to data from the Labor Department. That's a record number and is more than double what it was at the start of the recession. Census numbers released last week show that the poverty rate in that age group is growing. 9.4% of those between 55 and 64 were living in poverty in 2009.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batsh crazy. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. This afternoon, there was a rally at the state capitol that I attended. The Clear Coalition is calling for some smart taxation on the extraction of natural gas, our resource, on the companies that have come here from out of state, and from what I understand, maybe one or two of them from out, who knows where. Smart extraction tax. Pay for some of the things we need to do for our citizens, help with a school, help with roads, bridges, all of those things that we're talking about cutting, this would help us find a way to pay for them. And I heard Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, speak, and I said, you know what, let's get him on the program. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
The Clear Coalition, can you explain exactly what that is?
The Clear Coalition was a group of primarily unions, but some other groups who were concerned about the cuts in services have come together to fight for reasonable and responsible fair taxes, closing loopholes, making sure that we have the money to provide the services that the citizens of Pennsylvania need. You know, too often people just rail about taxes and think that the money goes down some kind of rat hole somewhere. But in fact, you know, their taxes pay for the paving of roads and the reconstruction of the bridges. We've seen so much of that as I travel the state. Thank God we're repairing bridges so that nobody died in a bridge collapse like they did in Minnesota several years ago. Our schools, you know, we fought long and hard to try and get smaller class sizes because we know our kids benefit from that. But now with budget cuts and because of the recession, because people's wages have been flat, as a result, you know, the tax revenues haven't been there in order to pay to have good teachers and to keep teachers in the classrooms. And, you know, now we're seeing bigger class size instead of smaller class size. And I, you know, it's unfortunate because I know folks are stretched. There's no question that, you know, extra taxes right now while you're, you know, you haven't had a pay increase in 10 years or, you know, you've lost your job. The last thing you want to hear about is taxes, except, you know, the things that we rely on every day, that businesses rely on, moving goods to market, are underwritten by infrastructure. You know, whether we have good ports and good rails and good roads and all those things that government, that people rely on every day and kind of forget that those are government services. The trash gets picked up. Your kids go to school. And part of what CLEAR's mission is to try to remind people and inform people about what the government does so that they can make informed decisions. We're not out here to sway folks or put our political ideology on anybody. We just want folks to kind of remember what their taxes go for and then make an informed decision about supporting candidates who support reasonable revenues. And one of the areas we're looking at, obviously, is the Marcellus Shale. Here's a natural resource that, you know, Pennsylvania is a commonwealth, unlike a lot of other states. We're a commonwealth, which means that the resources of the state, when William Penn designed the charter for Pennsylvania, that there would be certain things that went to the commonwealth of the entire population. Resources was one of those. You know, and it's we've found this huge reservoir of natural gas. Actually, finding it, we always knew it was there. The technology to extract it has finally come of age where you can do it in a way where it's cost effective, so that a company can go in and pull out the natural gas and make some money doing it, and get it to the market in a cheap and reasonable way, so that people can benefit from lower natural gas prices, getting us away from foreign oil. And relying more on the natural gas of our own state.
Right, and the thing is I'm calling this the gold rush of our generation. There is an absolute gold mine right underneath most of this state, and what I've been saying is it's in our land, and as you pointed out, this is a commonwealth. We should all benefit from our resource. We shouldn't allow people to come in from the outside, suck out the resource, leave us with a bunch of environmental problems and a bunch of raped land, and then flee to the next gold mine that they find.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, we do have most of the companies that are that have been experienced in drilling, and I'll pit our workers against any workers in the country, given the opportunity, could have done these drilling jobs and should be doing these drilling jobs. But they have brought in outside folks to do the drilling. And, you know, no way, you can't, how can I say this? You can't get resources out of the ground without some environmental damage. We know that. We make decisions based on, well, what's the impact? Is it worth it? And, you know, I think it is. We're certainly not calling for a moratorium like they have in New York, but we also want them to be responsible. And that's where the severance tax will come in handy because, you know, the natural gas isn't in always accessible places. So they have to build roads. They have to bring in men and equipment that require water and lots of water to do this process called fracking, I guess they call it. And so they're constantly pumping. They work 24/7, so they need electricity brought in. They need the pipelining to take the gas out. There's lots of jobs involved with this. But we also have got to make sure that when they leave and while they're there, that we do as much as we can to protect the environment. We want the resource, but we also don't want to leave, as you said, raped land and barren, you know, spots in our beautiful forests where our hunters go and our fishermen and, you know, folks go. Pennsylvania's got an incredible number of outdoor sports people, men and women who just love the outdoors, and we should be protecting those resources for them and their families while we responsibly get the gas. But ask the companies who are making millions off this, by the way. They're not doing this because they believe in the goodwill of Pennsylvania and taking on foreign oil. They're doing this for profits.
Absolutely.
That's what businesses do.
Sure.
But they need to pay a fair severance tax. Every state in the nation that has natural resource extraction has a severance tax. States that always claim that they're tax-free, like Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, they have extraction taxes and severance taxes on oil and gas and all the things, the very things that we're doing. Alaska.
The good socialist state of Alaska.
The good state where Sarah Palin is from. They have a huge extraction tax on oil to the point where every year every citizen of Alaska gets a check from the state for $100 to $1,200 because of the oil that's being pumped out of the Alaskan tundra. And that's the kind of extraction tax they've had. They fund their government almost exclusively with oil taxes and then have enough left over
to hand
give
out
the
to
citizens.
The citizens, yeah. Which is what we should be talking about here in the state of Pennsylvania. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Again, I want to go back to this tax issue because Tom Corbett has said, and I don't want to get all overly political, but he said he's taken this anti-tax pledge. If we don't get this tax, this extraction tax, passed in the next couple of weeks, I don't see that a Governor Corbett would push this through and we could lose the opportunity for some much-needed revenue.
Well, you know, first of all, and you're right, he has called for no taxes. Not even responsible ones. I mean, they have this idea that somehow they can, you know, wring more efficiencies. And you know, they're the first ones who complain that permits aren't getting done. But they laid off hundreds of people in the Department of Environmental Protection. So who's there to do the work? I mean, if you're serious about environmental protection and you want businesses to be smart, somebody's got to make sure they're not doing the wrong thing, like that mine owner in West Virginia who killed all those people because he was breaking every law there was. You've got to have people enforce that because sometimes greed overcomes common sense. And that's another one of the things that government does. That's one of the things that the Attorney General's office was supposed to do. And by the way, you know, again, this isn't a political segment, but you know, Tom Corbett's budget and the Attorney General's, he asked for an increase every year. So now he talks about cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. Well, what about the waste, fraud, and abuse in his department that, you know, he asked for more people, he asked for more vehicles. He ran an ad in the spring saying he was for reducing the fleet vehicles.
Well, except for his vehicles.
Except for his. He wanted more for his. But, you know, this isn't, we're not talking politics here, but you do have to have, you know, this responsible tax in order to make sure that, you know, the roads get taken care of. These guys are going over bridges that farmers have used for years to get their goods to market. Now they're taking these heavy-duty, you know, I don't even know how many ton dump trucks and equipment trucks over these bridges that weren't built for more than, you know, maybe 2 or 3 tons. I mean, and it's causing some real problems out there. And again, we want the development of the gas, but we got to make sure that we do the work and we tax them so that we can get the work done in order to make sure that the bridges are done well, are done safe, and to make sure that, you know, we're not leaving a mess behind because our farmers are always going to be here. The gas, once they get the gas up and into the compression stations, the drill rigs will move on and, you know, all you'll see is a little compression station out in the middle of nowhere where nobody, every once in a while, somebody will come by and service it. But our farmers still need those roads, and we can't let folks leave Pennsylvania without having contributed to making sure that the state can provide the resources and the services that the citizens of Pennsylvania need.
Now, on the other side of that, the homeowners, they need fresh drinking water. The farmers need water for their crops. We need somebody to oversee some of this stuff. And
right.
as you pointed out, they've cut the Department of Environmental Protection, where I think we should be doubling and maybe even tripling the size to make sure that, yeah, okay, they're extracting it, but they're doing it in a way that, as you pointed out, is less damaging than it could be. But the reality here is they are causing a problem, and we need to make sure that there is revenue available to rectify the problem when it comes up.
Right. You know, one of the funniest or saddest things you hear sometimes is, you know, from some conservatives who say, you know, cut government here, cut taxes here, you know, and then the minute that, like the whole welfare, the health care debate, you know, you had the folks saying, keep the government out of my Medicare,
yeah.
you know, which, of course, Medicare is one of the most efficiently run government programs using the private sector that's out there. And it was... And you still have folks who say, well, let's develop this gas, and then they say, well, but I don't want my drinking water ruined. Well, who protects your drinking water? I mean, folks forget that, you know, the government, look at the laws we passed, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, all those things. You know, I was down on the Susquehanna and saw a bald eagle. Now, when I first came to Pennsylvania in 1983, there were no eagles around because of the DDT, and it was those laws. It wasn't some company's well-being.
It was benevolence of some corporation.
Yeah, it was laws that forced companies to stop using DDT because we knew that they were making the eggshells weak and whatever the reasons were, that the beautiful predatory birds, the falcons, the hawks, the eagles, it was killing them.
Yeah.
And now you go around Pennsylvania, you see eagles and hawks. It's just beautiful. And it's because of responsible laws that said, wait a minute, let's balance environment and farming. And so we found other things other than DDT to handle pests. And, you know, it's been there are good laws out there. There are good government programs. And government does, for the most part, do good for its citizens. And this whole attack on government, driven by Wall Street, of course, who, wants to... take all the money out of the system and just give it to the rich and destroy the middle class and leave us, the rest of us, all very poor, because I know I'll never be one of those Wall Street millionaires. They're just pushing and pushing on this. And the minute we try to talk about fair taxes, and I was surprised that they didn't hit us right away with saying, oh, no taxes, let's get rid of the waste. Well, you know, we have gotten rid of, I'm sure there's still waste out there. Don't get me wrong. I mean, anytime you got humans involved, you're going to have, and that happens in the private sector as
yep.
well as the public sector.
So I would argue it happens more in the private sector.
Yeah, and having worked in the private sector for a big corporation before I started organizing, I saw lots of waste. And people are people. And, you know, sometimes we just got to cut each other some slack and, let's do what's right for Pennsylvania. Let's do what's right for workers. And, you know, let's get a fair tax. Let's get some money out of these guys who are making millions to help our schools, help, you know, rebuild our roads. Let's help our businesses out by giving them good transportation infrastructure.
And energy.
Honest, absolutely.
This will provide our businesses with energy. And the other part of it that we're not talking about is this is going to be a reasonable resource to help heat our homes in the wintertime and get us off of some of the fossil fuels, the coal, the oil. I think it's a good thing. And for me, it's a transition fluid fuel into the next renewable cycle, hopefully. What do you say to the people who say, well, if we put an extraction tax on, these big multi-billion-dollar companies aren't going to come here. They're going to go somewhere else.
Kind
of silly argument, I think.
It's a very silly argument. Given that the gas is here, are there other gas fields around? Yeah, but, you know, this one is so accessible to them. And, you know, like I said, every other state has an extraction tax. Canada has extraction taxes, which I guess is where one of the other big natural gas fields is. The other big one is in Texas. It's pretty much tapped out. If we are serious about fighting foreign oil, and if we are serious about America's security and fighting terrorism by getting off of the reliance on foreign oil,
energy
so we have energy independence, we don't have to deal with these dictators, who support terrorists, who want to kill us. If we are serious about that, then these companies should be here. They should be willing to pay a fair tax because the gas is here. Like you say, I mean, it's not like the garment industry we were talking about earlier, where they could say, oh, if you don't work for this wage, we're going to move, which they could. They could pick up their sewing machines and go to South Carolina, and then from there they went to Mexico and Guatemala, and now they're in China. They can't pick up the gas and go. It's here under the ground. If they don't develop it, somebody else will, because there's money to be made.
There's lots of money. They're estimating a couple $1 trillion worth of wealth under our ground, and I say we should get a part of that.
All right.
And I guess my last question for you is, what should I be doing? What should our listeners be doing? How do we get involved? What action should we be taking? Because I think people should be outraged by the fact we're only a couple of days away from the October 1st deadline, and I'm not hearing that there's a tax coming anytime soon.
Well, you know, our legislature, and they get beaten up plenty, and people are going to laugh when I say they do work hard. But, you know, if I missed as many deadlines as they did, I'd probably get fired.
I'm sure of it.
So, you know, they need to take this one seriously. They have a budget deadline that they actually came close to hitting this time. They said, let's do it by October 1st. They ought to do it by October 1st. And what your listeners can do and what they should do is contact their legislators and let them know that it's important for us to, in order to protect our environment, make sure, push for hiring Pennsylvania workers, that they pass a fair and equitable tax. Not a tax that gives the industry a 3-year exemption when they'll be all packed up and gone. Most of the tapping of the gas is done in the first 5 years. They've been here for 2. So not coincidentally, they're saying don't start it until 3 years from now because they'll be out of here. And the tax will just be on the gas that's pumping up, not the whole initial phase of the drilling. So we got to pass one that does what we need it to do, which is help us fund the folks who are going to make sure that this is done in a safe environmental way, a worker safety. Workers are safe doing this, that citizens are safe, that we don't have these big gas line explosions like they had in Clearfield. We got to make sure that we get the money that we need to make sure that this industry does it in a safe and responsible way and leaves us money to clean up
the
mess.
And that we benefit. And that way, for me, I say you put a massive tax on it and you give them credits to do the things that we want them to do. Help low-income people with energy in the wintertime. Make sure that you're hiring Pennsylvania workers. Make sure that you're hitting environmental targets. That's what we should be doing, and I hope that that's being considered.
Well, it certainly is, and like I said, your listeners can call their legislators, email them, fax. Well, nobody faxes much anymore. Email them or call them. Let them know that they support a fair and equitable severance tax on the extraction of natural gas here in Pennsylvania.
Amen. Rick Bloomingdale, I appreciate your time. President of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, we got a president who'll support the Employee Free Choice Act. I think we've got a majority in Congress that would support it. But again, you've got Democrats who aren't willing to stand up and fight. You know, and I got to tell you, you know, it's frustrating to see a lot of good things that this Congress has done. The one thing you cannot say about the 110th Congress, this Congress, this is the 110th, right, Brett? I think it's the one. But the one thing you can say about this Congress is they are not a do-nothing Congress like the Republicans were. They actually got some things done for you and me, for working people. And, you know, this this AP piece written by Erica Werner. Obama faults himself for not selling health care. Well, gee, no kidding. She writes, blaming himself for coolness to his health care overhaul, President Barack Obama is seeking to reintroduce the law to voters who don't much like or understand it 6 months after he signed it. And the key there is don't understand it. How can you not like something that you don't know anything about? And I've had numerous conversations with people who go, oh, death panels, death panel. You're going to have a bureaucrat sitting there deciding whether you live or die. No, you're not. And a new Associated poll found exactly that. The level of misunderstanding about what's actually in the law was scary. Scary. And, you know, some of the things that I think are important, the fact that we're ending rescission. And, you know, I was explaining this to my wife. I said, you know, do you remember back when you were a teenager? Remember you had that little acne problem and there was that drug? Because I remember it when I was in high school. All the girls were running to the dermatologist to get the anti-acne drug. I think it was tetracycline or something. I don't remember what it was. AZT or whatever. I don't remember the name of the drug, but there was this drug, and it cleared up your face marvelously. My problem is, caused cancer. And now here we are, 30 years later, with people who are now coming down and being diagnosed with cancer. And what you had is you had these insurance companies who would then go back through all their insurance records. They were little detectives, little Nancy Drews with their spyglass. Looking through your history, going, oh, let's see, you know, did they take this? Or women who took birth control, oh, okay, well, let's find this. And then they'd go back and say, well, you didn't report that you took this back when you were a teenager. You didn't report that you took this drug, and now, well, they think it causes cancer, so we're going to drop you. And now you're going to die. That's basically what was going on, because we have a pay-or-die system. And once your insurance company has the ability to go back into your past and say, oh, well, you know what? You didn't disclose this. And now we're going to drop you. One of the things he did away with that. No more rescission. No more denials for children with pre-existing conditions. Are we a family values society? I got to tell you, I don't think Mr. Family Values Mike Huckabee thinks we are, because he thinks pre-existing conditions are just fine. You're like a burned-down house. Damaged goods. And if you can't dig deep into your pockets and pay the doctor bill, well, sorry, better luck in the next life. Some of the other things in this bill that are going to take effect right now. This week, children can stay on their parents' health care until they're 26. That's a good thing for people who are in school. That's a good thing for people who are looking for their first job. Free immunization for all children. Again, are we a family values nation? Do we believe in children, or are we just a pro-birth? You know, I asked my anti-abortion people, are you pro-life or are you just pro-birth? Because one would think if we're going to have a healthy society, we should take care of the children, right? We love hearing about children. Oh, we love the cute little buggers. But we don't want to pay anything to keep them healthy. No, no, no. I don't want that. The new law says this week there are going to be free preventative care provided, such as mammograms and cholesterol screenings. Again, if we don't change the way we do medicine in this country, if we don't move from the reactive system that we have to a proactive system, to where we prevent people from getting sick in the first place, costs are going to continue to go through the roof. You know, it's like if you buy a car and you never change the oil, you're going to eventually replace that engine. And it's going to be a massive payday for somebody to replace your engine. But every couple of thousand miles, every 3,000-4,000 miles, you throw 10, 15 bucks into it to get the oil changed, that engine will last you a lot longer. The same thing with your body, with your health. You go to the doctor every year like I do. You get a checkup, you get a little blood test. Hey, everything looks okay. And if you can catch things early, it's going to cost an awful lot less. So I'm in favor of people going to the doctor more often as opposed to less often. The better a relationship I have with my doctor, and I got to tell you, I love my doctor. Good guy. You know, kind of guy you can go and he knows your family, he knows your history, he knows everything about you. And he follows your progress. Every person in this country should have a family doctor. And as a matter of policy, in Washington and Harrisburg or wherever, we should be encouraging people to get into family practice medicine. We should be figuring out how we can get them cheap loans and maybe even pay for it if they say, you know what, we're going to come back to Harrisburg and we're going to set up a family practice and we're going to help low-income working families. Smart policy. Because we know the costs born into the system are because people don't have that relationship with family doctors. What they've got is, oh, my God, my kid is sick. I hope and pray that the kid doesn't get any sicker. I hope and pray that my daughter, the temperature doesn't go up another degree. I hope and pray that the cough doesn't get worse. I hope and pray that my child is okay. Because I can't take him to the doctor because I don't have the insurance. I don't have the money in my pocket. So what happens? You hold off. You're hoping and praying and hoping and praying, and your child gets worse and worse and worse. And then, 3 o'clock in the morning, you can't take it anymore. You rush off to the emergency room where you are now paying the absolute highest premium for what could have been a quick visit to a family doctor and an antibiotic. Now, instead of $60 or $70 or $100, you're paying $500, $600, $1,000. $500, $600, $1,000 for what could have been very simple. So for me, that's what we've got to be talking about. Prevention. There are no more, this week, no more lifetime coverage limits. You know, I've told the story a number of times of the guy I worked with a couple years ago. His son had leukemia. And his wife had some problems earlier, several years earlier. They burned through $1 million in health care. And the insurance company said, well, you know what? Sorry. We had a $1 million per family lifetime cap. We can no longer pay any of your bills. And I got to be honest. Had that not been the union insurance company, that kid would have died. Because we in the union got together and we petitioned our health and welfare fund to change that, to make it $1 million per person instead of $1 million per family. And they did that because the members demanded it. And this kid got the treatment that he needs. And as I understand, he's doing well today. And that was 15 years ago. You got to do away with that. In this country, folks, you cannot possibly be in the middle class without some sort of health security. If you fall and break your leg in the parking lot, you're covered. Without, if your kid gets sick, you're not going to lose the house. If your wife falls ill, you're not going to lose all of your savings and everything you've ever worked for. The only way you stay in the middle class is with that kind of health security and some retirement security. That's it, folks. And this president had better get off his duff. And I think he's finally figured it out. this president had better get off his duff and say, this is what's in the bill, this is good stuff for working families, and this is going to help keep people in the middle class. The sad thing about this bill is most of the big things don't come until 2014. Because the insurance company said, it's going to take us time to get into that. And the conservatives said, we want to water this down so we can get people all riled up and tell stupid people that they're death panels. And you get people marching in the street saying dumb things on misspelled signs, which is what we've been seeing. The very people who this health care legislation would have helped. Look, am I happy with it? No. I would have rather had Medicare for All. Open it up. Tell me how much it's going to cost and charge each one of us that amount. And if you can't afford it, we'll provide subsidies. And if the infrastructure was there, it was all there. But again, the conservative movement on both sides of the aisle destroyed this. So we've got what we've got, and we've got to work from this point forward to make it better, like we did with Medicare. Medicare wasn't perfect. Far from it. But over time, senior citizens go, you know what? Hey, this is pretty good stuff. Pretty good stuff indeed. I think I would like some more. And we need to change things and make things better. And we did. And that's what we're going to have to do here, folks. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Here's today's number, 93.4. That's $93.4 million out that BP has now admitted to spending in just 4 months on its national advertising blitz, which is intended to put some gloss on its badly faded corporate image. Unless you've been under a big rock since BP's Gulf Oil out in April, it's been practically giant self-serving ads, which constantly blare from TVs and holler at us from the pages of all major city newspapers. This unprecedented PR campaign is run under a slogan proclaiming, "We will make this right." Each ad praises the British corporation's efforts in the Gulf region to clean up the mess, restore the ecology, and compensate the businesses and workers who've been suffering devastating losses. Heretofore, BP adamantly refused to disclose how much PR money it's been throwing into this puff and buff job, but Representative Kathy Castor of Florida, who serves on the House Energy Committee, demanded an accounting on behalf of the hard-hit folks in her district. "Every day you get up and see these full-page ads in every newspaper and the TV ads," she says, adding that it's really ticking people off. They're even more ticked off now that BP has admitted to spending more than $5 million a week on its window dressing effort. Its total ad expenditure for the 4 months came to $5 million more than it granted to four Gulf Coast states to help revive their decimated tourist industry. Worse, BP proceeded to insult the intelligence of the area's people by claiming that this huge ad outlay was necessary, quote, "to keep coastal residents informed." This is Jim Hightower saying, come on. BP has done all it can to deceive the people. Telling such blatant fibs as that is as useless as putting lipstick on a hog. It can't hide the ugliness that is BP.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, Detroit. Auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work the 40 hour week for a living. Just send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh. Steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work the 40 hour week for a living. Just send it on down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Or email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Jim writes, Accutane. AZT is for AIDS. So thank you for correcting me. I did, when I said it, I go, yeah, duh, that's the wrong one. I was looking for the acne drug. Speaking of Pittsburgh, there is a $452 million bid to lease the parking in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we talked about this the other day, that, you know, they're talking about privatizing the parking garages. And you've got this big money that's coming in, and J.P. Morgan is part of this. You know, one of the people we bailed out, now they're turning around, taking that money, using to buy us out. And what's interesting is we saw a report the other day from, I think it's KDKA, the TV station out there, that the rates for the parking, we're gonna skyrocket over the next 5 years. One of the garages they pointed out was going to go from $375 up to $12 an hour. A daily rate from $975 all the way up to $19 per day. There were other, the couple of the parking meters were going to go from $2 an hour up to $4.50 an hour. And, you know, in the outlying areas, are going to go from 50 cents an hour to anywhere between $1 and $3 an hour. So we're going to see this massive jump in parking fees and massive jump in the amount of money that commuters are going to have to pay to park their cars during the day at work. And my question is, why do we need a private for-profit corporation coming in raising these rates? Why don't we just do that ourselves? Why don't we just raise the parking fees and say, you know what? Sorry, you know, we got some tough times. We're going to have to raise these fees a little bit, and we're going to use that money to for the betterment of the city. Why do we have to have a private for-profit interest coming in, giving us a good chunk of money up front? But believe when I tell you, they are going to get that money back in spades. You know, they wouldn't put themselves in the middle of this if there weren't massive amounts of profit to be made on this. And, you know, this company that they're talking about operating, LAZ, they operate in 99 cities, including Chicago's privately managed parking system. So they're making a lot of money, folks. And we're seeing this privatization across the spectrum. For short-term needs, we're selling off our assets. For short-term fixes, again, we're selling off what we, the taxpayers, built. And even here in Harrisburg, we're talking about we're gonna talk about selling off the parking garages here, selling off the turnpike, state investment, stuff that we put up the money to do, we're gonna hand over to private for-profit corporations. $452 million is a lot of money, but rest assured, they are gonna make that back. Because nobody's been able to show me where this privatization has benefited us. We're still going to get stuck paying the bill, one way or another. You and me, we're going to pay it. And the difference is who do you want to pay it to? Do we want to pay it to the investor class, the people who are going to invest in this, the Forbes 400? I mean, the names on this list, the Carlyle Group, J.P. Morgan, the people bidding on this stuff, this isn't Joe and Bob from down the street. These are global investors who are consolidating the wealth of this country into the hands of a very, very few. And we're going to hear it in this transportation bill. We're going to hear the call for more mergers and consolidation, more public-private partnerships, which means, to me, a public-private partnership means the public is going to put up the money and the private is going to profit. That's what it means to me. That means you and I are going to dig into our pocket, we're going to pay taxes, they're going to build something, be it a turnpike or a parking garage, and then we're going to lease it off for a small amount of money back, and the private interest is going to profit wildly. At least that's been my experience. If anybody has any examples where that is not the case, I would sure like to know. I would sure like to know where privatization and deregulation have benefited me and people like me. I want to know it. So if you know, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, because I have yet to find it. What I've found is exactly what I've been saying. We put out a bunch of money out of our pocket, and they benefit. And then we end up paying higher rates. I mean, this is just outrageous. To go from $3.75 an hour all the way up to $12 an hour. From $9.75 to almost $19 a day. That, my friends, is outrageous. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this with your call. Stick around.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make somehow.
One of the places where I see change needed is in the U.S. Senate. The seat in particular, the seat held by Senator Diaper Dave Vitter, Republican from Louisiana. Today, CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, we've been talking a lot about them lately, but look, they're the people who are paying attention to this stuff. They filed a complaint with the Senate Ethics Committee against Diaper Dave over his improper use of taxpayer funds to subsidize the personal expenses of staff member Brett Furrer, and for lying about Furrer's legislative portfolio. Mr. Furrer is infamous for brutally assaulting his girlfriend in 2008 while handling women's issues for Senator Diaper Dave. According to the Senate financial records, at taxpayers' expense, Mr. Furrer flew to Louisiana in 2007 to appear in court to face a DUI charge, and again in 2008 to sign his probation agreement in the same matter. Senator Vitter's office claimed the senator was unaware of the court proceedings. I don't think so. Look, if you've got a guy who's got some court problems and you're a U.S. senator, you had better damn well know he's got problems. The CREW report goes on to say, notably, the entire time Mr. Furrer worked for Senator Vitter, he traveled to Louisiana on taxpayers' dime 6 times, making it a remarkable coincidence that 2 of those trips coincided with Mr. Furr's court dates. So he went back and forth to Louisiana just six times over all the time he worked there. And two of them just happened to be, you know, just worked out that way. Worked out to be my court dates. Moreover, one of these trips took place while the Senate was in session and debating an amendment Senator Vitter had introduced that fell under Mr. Furr's legislative responsibilities. Under Senate rules, taxpayer funds may not be used for personal trips. Understand that. You know, the reality is, look, this is the thing that Christine O'Donnell is going to find out. You cannot use taxpayer dollars. You cannot use campaign dollars to do your personal things. The report goes on to say, although Senator Vitter's spokesperson claimed Mr. Furr was significantly disciplined for attacking his girlfriend and was allegedly suspended for work for 3 months, Senate financial records show he was paid for all but 5 days during that period. So outwardly they're saying, well, we suspended him, but Senate financial records show he was still collecting his paycheck. It goes on to say taxpayers should not pay for violent criminals to go on holiday. Melanie Sloan, who I'm really falling in love with this woman. I think she's got a good size set. She goes on to say, yet it seems clear that Senator Vitter's idea of significant discipline for a women's issue staffer who stabbed and threatened his girlfriend is what most people would call a paid vacation. What could be more offensive than that? And I agree. Look, the guy should have been fired. Bottom line. But, you know, you've got this loyalty pact. You know, I should have, to be honest, I thought Diaper Dave should have stepped down when it came out that he was, you know, maybe seeing the D.C. madam, which mysteriously she turned up to be missing. And then she ended up, they found her dead. Kind of makes you wonder. In another Senate office, and gee, you know, I got to tell you, I just love Republicans. Always something fun to talk about. Senator Saxby Chambliss's office. Newser writes, Rob Quinn, quote, the hatred of gays and a lack of IT savvy are likely to add up to unemployment for someone in Senator Saxby Chambliss's office. A commenter calling himself Jimmy left a post reading, quote, all faggots must die, on a popular blog, Joe My God. Soon after, a measure to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell was blocked yesterday. Other readers soon traced that IP address back to the Senate.gov IP, and it turned out that there it was, somebody who works for Saxby Chambliss. Are we surprised? I mean, are you really surprised that somebody with a small brain like that would say something like that and expect not to be found? Joe Jervis, a blogger, noted, among the fields in which gay people are overrepresented, one is the IT field. Look, folks, if you do something online, it's not anonymous. Even though you write your name as anonymous, it's not anonymous. Anybody with half a savvy with the computer can find you. Granted, I'm not one of those, but I have people who can find it. So, you know, when you write stupid stuff like this, it eventually comes back, especially if you're working for our government. And do we really want those kind of short-sighted, simple-minded people working in the halls of power? Do we? I mean, do we really want homophobes and racists holding the levers of power? I don't. I don't want these people anywhere near power. And yet that seems to be what's going on in this country. We've allowed the Tea Party to take over the message. And we've got a complicit media in this country who just loves a story, and they provide them a story. And I'm asking sane people, look, you may not be in favor of gay marriage. You may not be in favor of it at all. But the right of people to do what consenting adults want to do in their home should be something we all agree on. And I often go back to the Pastor Niemöller quote. You know, first they came for the communists, and I said nothing because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the trade unionists. And I said nothing because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I said nothing because I wasn't a Jew. And by the time they came for me, there was nobody left. So if we let them take down one group, how long is it before they get to you? That's the great thing about this country. And it's one of the major things that I love, is that you have the right to be who you are and who you want to be. And you have the right to do whatever you want to do, as long as your right doesn't infringe upon mine. And this nonsense that we've got a very small segment of the population who's animately opposed to this stuff, out there being the squeaky wheel, is concerning to me. Because I think rational people need to stand up. And I'm really hoping, as I've said the past couple of days, that Christine O'Donnell is going to be that kamikaze. Just like the kamikazes smashed into the boats in Pearl Harbor, I'm saying Christine O'Donnell's going to take down the Tea Party. She's going to blow the hole out of the bottom of the teapot. Because sane people, the sleeping majority, the sleeping giants are going to wake up. The people who haven't been paying attention because they're working too damn hard to put food on the table, and they're working harder and harder every day to put food on the table, they're waking up to the fact that crazy has left the train station. So I'm asking you folks, pay attention to what's going on. Look at what these folks are saying. Because it's dangerous, dangerous stuff. And until sane people take back control of our government. And look, I'm not thrilled with the people who are running things. I'm not thrilled with the Grand Obstructionist Party. I'm not thrilled with the fact that this health care bill didn't go the way we were hoping it would go. And, you know, maybe the best thing to happen, be in November that the Republicans win, so that they can no longer obstruct. That we, the people, will expect them to do something. Look, if you don't like the health care bill, tell me what we're going to do instead. Tell me how we cover almost 51 million people. Because not all 51 million of those people are low-life degenerates who don't want to work. As I hear my friends who just despise this bill say, well, the only people who don't have health care are people who are too lazy to work. Really? Well, there are 51 million of them. 51 million people. A sixth of our population. Not all of them are lazy and shiftless. Most of them are families. Most of them are people who need help. And if we call ourselves a Christian nation, if we call ourselves a nation of family values, a community, we should leave no one uninsured. We should separate out no one. If you've got rights, everybody should have rights. And, you know, what I love is I've got friends who say, well, you know, it's my right to smoke. I get this nonsense all the time. My right to smoke. Who's the government to tell me I can't smoke? I go, well, it's my right to breathe clean air. When we go into a restaurant, I got somebody sitting next to me smoking. Is that not detrimental to my health? Are my rights not being infringed? And most of the time, you know, people stop and go, you know, I think you're right. I said, well, you know, I used to chew tobacco. I used to dip snuff as a kid. What happened if I decided, you know, I'm going to spit on your shoe? I got to spit. It's my right to spit. I should be able to spit right on top of your shoe, right? Well, no. What makes you think you can blow smoke in my face? Again, it comes down to you got the right to do whatever you want to do until your right infringes on someone else's. And you may have the belief that gay marriage and gays are deviants or whatever, but you don't have the right to tell them what they can do. You don't have the right. You have the right not to engage in that activity. You've got that right. But you really don't have the right to tell them what to do. And I don't think most people want to do that. They may not like it. Don't understand it. But you don't want to take it away from them. Because what's next? It's that simple for me. Again, you want to reach me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails here at the program. And if you want to talk to us, 1-888-520-RICK. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans attended a welcome back ceremony for auto workers in Tennessee, but there wasn't much rejoicing. Jesse Russell reports.
Tennessee Republican Bob Corker wasn't greeted with much enthusiasm during a ceremony welcoming workers back to a Spring Hill, Tennessee auto manufacturing plant. Corker joined two other Republican lawmakers for the ceremony, which saw General Motors welcoming 483 workers back to the plant. According to online auto magazine Jalopnik, Corker was booed when he claimed to have contributed to helping strengthen the auto industry in the country. Corker, along with the two other Republicans in attendance, Senator Lamar Alexander and Representative Marsha Blackburn, all opposed the Obama administration's successful auto industry bailout bid. In March of 2009, Corker called the move a major power grab. Alexander said in March of 2009 that the bailout was a move in the wrong direction, and Blackburn said in December of 2008 that Obama's plan wouldn't make the industry more successful or efficient. According to Jalopnik, an official from the UAW made it clear auto workers will remember at election time the politicians that refused to help the ailing auto industry.
New York City's largest public employee union, AFSCME's DC 37, says a restructuring plan for Health and Hospitals Corp. is a slash-and-burn plan with a deeply flawed cost-benefit analysis that undermines public health care. DC 37 President Lillian Roberts says the plan will hurt hundreds of thousands of people without health insurance who depend on HHC for health care.
It's going to suffer because of it, because we expect the patient population has been increasing by large numbers, and we know that it will increase more.
The union says the restructuring plan is misguided in proposing to eliminate 3,700 full-time equivalent employees who deliver these vital services to communities in New York City.
If you're going to contract out anything, it has to be contracted out, and the person's expected to make profit. We all pay for that, and I think it's disgusting because that is a demand service, and we're not talking about cans of peas. We're talking about human beings.
Nearly half of the more than 2.2 million unemployed workers who are 55 years of age or older have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. That's according to data from the Labor Department. That's a record number and is more than double what it was at the start of the recession. Census numbers released last week show that the poverty rate in that age group is growing. 9.4% of those between 55 and 64 were living in poverty in 2009.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. More and more reports are coming out about our highly centralized food supply. We're seeing more recalls, like the recent ones with eggs and deli meats for Walmart. The recent facelift name change of high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar. You figure that out. I can't. Have many people asking, should we be worried? And now you see this story about frankenfish, which are these salmon that grow twice as fast, twice as big as regular salmon, has people wondering. I've asked Winona Hodder, executive director of the Food and Water Watch, foodandwaterwatch.org is their website, to come talk to us a little bit about the frankenfish. Winona, welcome to the program.
So glad to be here.
I appreciate you taking time for us. You know, I look at the size of these monster fish and I go, how's this possible?
Well, you know, the pictures are actually kind of misleading, too. it's not that this fish will ever be bigger. It's that it grows twice as fast. And so they've taken a juvenile regular salmon and shown it against a GE salmon. We think they kind of look like obese salmon. But then the whole process has been pretty dishonest. The Food and Drug Administration is using a process to approve veterinary drugs to bring this GE food to market.
So we're pumping basically steroids into these fish?
Well, what they do is they take a gene from an ocean pond and insert it into an Atlantic salmon, and this increases the hormonal activity, and so there's actually more of the hormone, it's called insulin-like growth factor. It's the same hormone that was so controversial with milk, with the RBGH milk, and so many people refuse to buy milk that's been produced using this hormone that, you know, it's there's hardly any of this milk still on the market. So this is basically what's increasing the ability of the salmon to grow quickly. Now, what's so disconcerting is the very poor risk assessment that the FDA used in making the determination in their briefing packet that the salmon is safe. The analysis of this insulin-like growth factor or the hormone looked at only two studies, the GE salmon's nutritional content. They looked at one data set, and for the potential allergic reactions, they looked at one. Now, of these four studies, which were the basis for the FDA saying this is safe, three of which weren't peer-reviewed, and the 14th or the fourth one was 18 years old. We're especially concerned about the study with the on the subject of allergic reactions. They used six fish to determine that it was safe, and actually, even with this small sample size, it shows a statistically significant difference in the allergenic potency of the salmon. Even the FDA acknowledged that there was a problem. And there were some other very serious irregularities with the research. The company that supplied these three main studies, their primary investigator left in the middle of the analysis. And the company scientists actually disclosed which were the GE and the non-GE fish during the experiment, and that's a serious violation of the fundamentals of the scientific method. And the most disturbing fact of all is that they killed all of the salmon that were deformed before they did their analysis.
Wow. I'm generally against our FDA or any government agency taking solely one party's word, even if it is doctored. This just makes me want to scream.
Yeah, you know, even this advisory committee, and it wasn't a food safety advisory committee, it was a veterinary advisory committee made up of veterinarians and people with experience in animal science. Even they, and most of them are pro-biotech, even they were very critical of the science that was used and the poor job that the FDA had done. And so the FDA has said, well, I guess we need more research. But, you know, we know that there's a lot of political pressure on the FDA to approve this fish. There are a lot of other approvals looming, like the pig that's genetically engineered. And so we really want people to let their elected officials and the Obama administration know that they don't want to eat this stuff. And we did a poll that we released on Monday that showed that 78% of Americans were opposed to this approval.
Only 78%?
Well, other polls have shown 93%, but we were very careful with the wording because we didn't want it to be a push poll.
Because I got to tell
you. But, you know, that was a crawl. What's interesting is that 78, almost 80%, was across every
demographic.
Demographic, age, political affiliation, gender. So moms, of course, were the highest. And that was the 78% was an average.
Yeah, because who wants to feed their kids, you know, genetically modified food?
No. Mothers who are aware of these issues don't want to. And we're infuriated that it looks like it's likely based on what they've done with other foods that they wouldn't label it.
See, this is what frustrates me. We really don't have the ability as consumers to stop this. Because once this gets passed, and this is what really bothers me, once this fish becomes something that's on the market, everybody else is going to have to do it as well. Because they're going to be able to do it cheaper, and people are going to normally flock to the cheaper price, and we're going to end up having the entire industry move towards that, and you're going to have a much harder time finding decent fish, or I don't even know how to put it, regular, healthy fish.
That's right. You know, they're just messing with our diet. It's very frightening because we know there will be a lot more products down the pike. And there haven't been any long-term health studies on genetically engineered foods. And I bet most people would be surprised that lots of the processed and junk food, actually, that's on the market has GE products. For instance, anything that's made with corn or soy oil, or if you look at an ingredient and it says lecithin, that's probably made, unless it's organic, with a genetically engineered material. And we don't know what the health consequences are. We know Americans are getting heavier. We know, you know, that there are health problems, but there's been no research to know what part genetically engineered food might play.
Well, here's the thing with that. I mean, if we're relying on the corporations to do the research to get this stuff passed, do you really think that they're going to do the research to see how their product is killing people?
Absolutely not. And we've just seen through this process Aqua Bounty. And, you know, this is a company that lost $5 million last year and is on the brink of bankruptcy. They're going to do everything that they can to get this product to market. And do we really want a company that hasn't been able to stay in business to be doing the scientific research and to be making decisions about this?
I know I don't. Because, you know, when I saw this, when I read the story originally, and I'm glad you clarified for me, I thought the fish got to be twice as large. We would have these monster fish. All we're really talking about is speeding up, in a really bizarre way, speeding up the maturation process.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we've heard all of these bogus arguments that salmon are going to feed the world. And, you know, that really upsets me because, first of all, salmon have to be fed other fish. So any kind of salmon is not a fish that is going to help people in the developing world deal with hunger. It's too expensive, and it wouldn't be the kind of fish that you would grow to feed people. You'd do something like a sardine or an oily fish. And, you know, it's just a lie and a smokescreen that they're coming up with. And I've heard commentators, like on major media, talk about the potential to feed the world.
Well, that's the talking point. We're going to be able to make twice as much because, and I got to be honest, when I read the stories, I thought, wow, they're going to make fish that are twice as large and they're going to feed twice as many people.
Right.
And I think that point that you made is really important because what we're looking at is speeding up profits, not actually about creating more food, but just speeding up the profit margin.
Right. And, you know, and we're really concerned about the illegal trafficking of the eggs, too. Because this whole debate has been about a grow-out facility in Panama, not even in the U.S. And if these eggs actually do grow fish that grow faster, I mean, we're doubtful that a lot of their claims are even true. But if they do, these eggs are going to be in high demand for the kind of net fish farming that we see in the open ocean. And every year, hundreds of thousands of fish in ocean net pens get out, because, you know, it only takes a little tear. It's not rocket science. And it could be devastating to wild stocks if these fish get out, both in terms of mating, and there's been a lot of misinformation about their sterility. Most of the eggs are sterile. About 5% are fertile. And so we would be depending on the company not selling the fertile eggs, or some company employee not stealing eggs and selling eggs, or the eggs are sent to places like China, where they could be, you know, sold to places that actually do produce salmon.
And then shipped back here into the U.S.
I mean, once these eggs get out, it could be very dangerous. And these fish grown in factory fish farms have to be given antibiotics and all sorts of fungicides, and they have a lot of disease. And there was no study of how these diseases could impact fish out in the ocean if they do get loose.
Amazing stuff. And, you know, the bigger question that we should be having a conversation on, and I would love to have you back at some point in the near future to talk about, our food supply and this centralization and this, you know, it used to be the movie Animal Farm, and now it's Animal Factory, because we're not producing food like we used to. Now it's almost an assembly line situation.
I would love to come back and talk about it. I mean, we're beginning to gear up for the 2012 Farm Bill. We want to see some really different policies. So the incentive is for regional food systems as much as possible,
yep,
with foods being produced in a more sustainable and a healthy way, not just to be more profitable.
I'm right there with you. So that when we don't see a half a billion eggs being recalled and 1,300 people nationwide sick from something that I'm guessing now they've figured out that they could have prevented right from the beginning.
Absolutely. And, you know, our Food and Drug Administration, rather than bringing these controversial foods to market, they should concentrate on their central purpose, which is providing safe foods so we don't have tainted eggs and poisoned peanuts and bad spinach or all of the drugs that have been recalled. Let's have a better FDA that does their job and doesn't have this flimsy science.
No, not business-friendly. I don't want a business-friendly FDA. I want a human-friendly. Winona Hodder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. Foodandwaterwatch.org is the website. I appreciate your time. Thank you for the information on this. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have a great night. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Here's today's number, 93.4. That's $93.4 million, the amount that BP has now admitted to spending in just 4 months on its national advertising blitz, which is intended to put some gloss on its badly faded corporate image. Unless you've been under a big rock since BP's Gulf Oil blowout in April, it's been practically impossible to avoid the giant's self-serving ads, which constantly blare from TVs and holler at us from the pages of all major city newspapers. This unprecedented PR campaign is run under a slogan proclaiming, "We will make this right." Each ad praises the British corporation's efforts in the Gulf region to clean up the mess, restore the ecology, and compensate the businesses and workers who've been suffering devastating losses. Heretofore, BP adamantly refused to disclose how much PR money it's been throwing into this puff and buff job, but Representative Kathy Castor of Florida, who serves on the House Energy Committee, demanded an accounting on behalf of the hard-hit folks in her district. "Every day you get up and see these full-page ads in every newspaper and the TV ads," she says, adding that it's really ticking people off. They're even more ticked off now that BP has admitted to spending more than $5 million a week on its window dressing effort. Its total ad expenditure for the 4 months came to $5 million more than it granted to four Gulf Coast states to help revive their decimated tourist industry. Worse, BP proceeded to insult the intelligence of the area's people by claiming that this huge ad outlay was necessary, quote, "to keep coastal residents informed." This is Jim Hightower saying, come on. BP has done all it can to deceive the people. Telling such blatant fibs as that is as useless as putting lipstick on a hog. It can't hide the ugliness that is BP.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, if food wasn't bad enough, Reuters is reporting that a fashion design pack leaving London for Milan, one designer and a professor of particular matter of technology unveiled his own unique collection of clothes made of spray-on fabric. The pair, Manuel Torres and Paul Luckman, are perfecting a fabric that can be sprayed onto skin and other surfaces to make clothing, medical bandages, and even upholstery. Torres, a visiting academic at Imperial College London, approached Luckham, an Imperial College professor, about the particle technology to help him realize his dreams of spray-on garments that can be taken off, washed, and worn again. So they sprayed this stuff on this model, and she said, oh, it's nice, actually. It's just like a second skin. The system uses short fibers such as wool, linen, and acrylics mixed with polymers to bind them together. The solvent, which evaporates on contact with surface, allows the fibers to be sprayed out of a can as a liquid. So what will we come up with next? Kind of makes you wonder, folks. We're going to take a quick call. We got Mike on line two. How are we doing today, Mike?
Hi, Rick. How you doing? Hey, I was listening to the discussion earlier about the taxing of the Marcellus Shale and extraction tax.
Yep.
People may not realize that we are perilously close to getting into very big trouble in Pennsylvania, because should a certain individual be successful in his effort to become governor, he's taken an oath not to raise taxes, period, end discussion.
Right.
If this tax isn't approved before the election, then it's likely that that tax will never be approved.
And the state could lose billions of dollars in revenue, much needed revenue. And look, I'll say it, Tom Corbett took the no tax pledge.
Yes,
and the reality is, I think he's bullheaded enough. I think he's politically driven enough not to do what George H.W. Bush did back in the 90s and raise taxes when they were desperately needed. I don't think this guy would do that. I think he is ideologically driven and he is politically driven to hold up to those words so he can be reelected.
Well, and you're right. And basically what this is, you remember something called Tabor?
Oh, I sure do.
Okay. The election of Corbett with this pledge is de facto Tabor.
Yeah, the chocolate-covered lemon. I do remember it.
Okay. So basically it'll put us in a position of he'll just cut if we don't get more money. And we know full well in the first 6 months of this next administration, there are a couple of things that happen. One is a lot of very large labor contracts will be renegotiated. Secondly, we're going to see the bill come due for the pension fund. And with no intention of raising taxes and a declining economy, still declining revenue for taxes, Mr. Corbett's pledge really can lead to the destruction of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
I would argue 2 points. One, I think that's what the conservatives want. I think that's what the conservatives want. They want that chaos. They want social programs to be just ripped out of the government. And then there's the other thought that I have, like Michael Linden said earlier in the program, that he doesn't really believe that. It's just electioneering. It's just sloganeering to get them elected because they haven't done it to this point. You know, Reagan ran on smaller government and tripled the size of government. George Bush ran on smaller government. Look what he did to it. You know, I'm hoping Michael's right, but, you know, they're both sides of that argument.
I wonder, do we want to risk it?
No, I don't.
Because right now, my assessment is we're starting to see the city of Harrisburg unraveling. Crime is really ramping up. And there's not a spare nickel anywhere to do anything. And if that continues, things are going to get very ugly very fast.
And the sad thing is, Mike, is there is a source of revenue that we've already lost tens of millions of dollars on, and that is to go and have a smart tax on what they're taking out of our ground. And that's the Marcellus Shale natural gas.
Yeah.
That's the smart thing to do. But the reality is Republicans are so ideologically opposed to raising taxes and so afraid that the Democrats are going to look like they're actually making government work that Republicans are going to stand in the way of progress again.
I'm afraid you might be right.
I hope I'm. Mike, I appreciate the call. Thanks, buddy.
Yep.
Let's move on over to Jim. How are we doing today, Jim? Jim, are you there? I think we lost Jim.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
Good. How are you today, Jim?
You know, first, three things. When you're talking about this governor, so many politicians are somewhat redolent of the governor that was portrayed by Mel Brooks in Blazing Saddles, Governor LePelletier.
Yes, sir. Love that movie.
Really. And, you know, as far as this woman in Delaware is concerned, politicians who are running for office or who are in office should be subject to the same rules that career federal civil servants are subject to.
Absolutely.
And that's fraud, waste, and abuse. Because if you're found guilty of that, for example, like misusing your government credit card or whatever, you can be terminated immediately.
Immediately. And you should be.
Absolutely.
See, because
and
I do believe.
The third thing, as far as our food supply is concerned, we're going back almost to the days of Upton Sinclair in the Blackboard Jungle in the meatpacking industry.
Yep.
And what you have here are the heads of federal agencies who are Schedule C or political appointees subject to pressure, having no conscience, pressuring federal civil servants who are regular career people not being able to do their jobs. And if they, you know, bring this to the light, they're called whistleblowers and are subject to a tremendous amount of negative pressure.
Yep.
And their careers can be ended. And the protection afforded by federal agencies appointed to ensure the purity of our food and drug supply doesn't exist anymore.
And it's frustrating. And one of the things
all this is coagulates with deregulation and the diminution of the federal government as a protector of the people.
Yeah,
that's my point.
Excellent point. Excellent made point. Spot on. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate the information. No, look, you know, one of the things I said about the president when he took office was my hope that we would reinvigorate the oversight, that we would have more transparency, more oversight, more inspectors, more regulation to make sure that our food and our water and our air are clean and pure the way they're supposed to be. After 8 years of George W. Bush saying, you know what, we're going to use these offices as patronage jobs for our CEO buddies. And that's what that's turned into, this swinging door between the regulatory heads and in the CEO boardrooms. At some point, I want boring, simple career bureaucrats doing what they do best, what they've been trained to do. And that's inspect the mines so we don't have miners killed because, well, you know, the only thing we do here in the coal mine is run coal. We don't need to put up no timbers or do no safety stuff. We just run coal because coal pays the bills. So if you don't have anybody overseeing that, what happens? You have 29 dead miners. If you don't have anybody inspecting eggs, what do you have? You got a half a billion eggs being recalled and 1,300 people sick. You don't have people checking the lettuce or the spinach or any of that stuff. What do you end up with? You end up with a bunch of people sick. You don't have people checking the scallions. You end up with, you know, like in Pittsburgh years ago, with a whole bunch of people with hepatitis. You know, at some point, I want those boring bureaucrats doing the jobs that they're trained to do. Without pressure from corporations, I want them to have the power to walk into a coal mine and say, you know what? I don't think this is safe. We're shutting it down. I want them to be able to walk into a meatpacking plant with hundreds of thousands of pounds of deli meat going to Walmart that may be tainted, saying, you know what? Don't look right to me. Shutting it down. story after story, we see the power of the centralization of our food production is overpowering our regulatory ability to keep the public safe. And again, it's back to this conservative ideology. Again, we're talking about the failures of government. And I'm a guy who says, you know what? I want my government to inspect food. I want my government to do these things. But they're failing. And the sheer fact that we're talking about it means mission accomplished for the conservative movement, because they have sufficiently starved the beast. They're able to drag our government into the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub. Because, look, they put people in charge of these agencies who didn't know what the hell they were doing. You know, heck of a job, Brownie, head of FEMA, are you kidding me? And then we're surprised when the agency fails? You know, I've always wondered why there are people in this country who vote for politicians who say, you know what, I don't believe in government. Government can't do nothing. I believe in the private sector. Well, you know what, if you believe in the private sector, go over to the private sector. I want somebody who believes in the power of we the people. I want somebody who believes that a government program can help people, can lift people out of poverty. Because I'm one of those people that it happened to. Now, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I'd probably be dead if it weren't for health care that our government got for me when I had a massive asthma attack. I'd probably be in jail stealing food to put on the table, because if it weren't for food stamps, we'd have nothing. And I remember that. You know, I could easily be the Horatio Alger that the right loves to talk about. I grew up where they put the socioeconomic ladder. And now I've moved up several rungs. I live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers, and my kids, they are never going to see the brutal misery that I grew up in. Never. And that's the great thing about this country, and I want that to be passed on to the next generation and the next and the next. And it sickens me that we've got a class of billionaires in this country while there are people starving and going without health care. It absolutely sickens me. We're going to take a quick break. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. You won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know,
together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind, question, comment, something under your skin. Keystone Progress, one of our friends, has filed a suit in Commonwealth Court. They did that today, appealing the Office of the Attorney General's denial of its right-to-know request. Keystone Progress's suit is seeking information on correspondence concerning Attorney General Tom Corbett's politically motivated suit to overturn the federal health care reform legislation. Keystone Progress has been denied this information in two requests and is appealing the second denial. The suit by Keystone Progress rebuts each of the OAG's Office of Attorney General's reasons for denying Keystone Progress's appeal. Mike Morrill, Keystone Progress's executive director, said, "We are saddened that we have to take the Attorney General to court. The Office of the Attorney General should be above reproach and should be setting an example for transparency and following the letter of the law. We know that the Office of Attorney General has been in correspondence with some of the political entities in our suit because we have copies of the correspondence. We just do not know the extent of the interaction. It might be within the bounds of the law, or it could be using the Office of Attorney General for political purposes. We're suing Corbett's office to answer that question." And look, you've got 14 states' attorney generals who are banding together, most of them seem to be running for governor, looking to walk up the ladder, who are mostly Republicans. To me, seems pretty politically motivated. I think there are bigger fish out there to fry. In fact, from the legal intelligencer here, a Commonwealth court judge has ordered pharmaceutical company Bristol-Myers Squibb to stop inflating the wholesale prices of its drugs purchased by the state's pharmaceutical drug program for the poor and elderly. Commonwealth Judge Robert E. Simpson said in a September 10th order in Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Bristol-Myers Squibb Company that Bristol-Myers, headquartered in New York City, violated the Pennsylvania Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Law with unfair or deceptive practices. The judge said Bristol-Myers owes the state $27.6 million for prices of drugs charged in violation of fair trade practices. But the judge said that his orders, that he was not awarding damages or attorney fees. The judge said that he did not have sufficient information to calculate civil penalties because the plaintiff's expert did not limit his information to how many times the wholesale price changed for Bristol-Myers Squibb from 1991 to 2004. Here's the part that I find interesting. The Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office retained outside counsel Donald E. Haviland Jr. of Haviland Hughes in Philadelphia to prosecute the civil claims on its behalf. So, let me lay this out a little bit, because this is how I'm kind of thinking about this stuff. You've got an attorney general who goes, you know, politically, I can sign on to this lawsuit, I can use my office to pursue overturning the health care legislation, but I really don't have time to go after this big corporation who's cheating the state out of big bucks. I don't have the time for that. So we're gonna outsource that work so I can focus on what's really important, going after Democrats and going after the health care. Kind of makes you wonder. Haviland said the judge's ruling will help the state's program continue to fulfill their mission of providing health care benefits to some of the most vulnerable members of society. The plaintiff argued that Bristol-Myers Squibb overcharged the state of Pennsylvania $114 million for more than 20 drugs. So I got to tell you, you know, I'm starting to think in terms of criminal Wall Street kind of ideas. I can overcharge $114 million. And I only have to pay back $27.6 million of it. I think that's a pretty good deal. And I don't have to go to jail. As a corporation, I don't have to go to jail over this. I can cheat the taxpayers of the state, and I don't have to go to jail because I'm a corporation. Yet on the other hand, you got people who are saying, well, you know, corporations are people. They've got corporate personhood. If that's the case, then I say we throw Bristol-Myers Squibb in jail. What they did was wrong. If you or I pulled that nonsense, we'd be sitting in jail, wouldn't we? I'm pretty sure we would be. They'd lock us up tighter than... Well, I don't want to go in there. I'm not going to get to that. That can lead me into a lot of trouble. Into a lot of trouble. Kiruri over at Crooks and Liars wrote, voter suppression in Wisconsin, courtesy of the GOP and Americans for Prosperity. Gee, where have we heard Americans for Prosperity? Could that be one of the Tea Party front groups funded by the, call it what you want, Cook, Coke, or Koch group? I'm not sure which. I've heard all three. The billionaires, you know, the two brothers on the top 10 of the billionaires list that we talked about today. Here's what he writes. If you can't win the vote fairly, suppress voters. This has been the Republican tactic for years. It's running rampant in Wisconsin, he writes, while polls are showing Russ Feingold at a shocking disadvantage to his teabagger opponent, Russ Johnson. The GOP and Americans for Prosperity are working behind the scenes on a voter suppression scam that is on a far wider scale, but no different than the one that they've used for years. Now, remember, look, Republicans have been using caging for years, and it's basically what they're doing here. And if you don't know what caging is, it's pretty simple. They go through, the voter rolls, and they say, okay, this guy's 20 years old. Chances are he's either a college student or he's moved a couple of times. Or we go into a blighted neighborhood and we say, okay, well, you know, this neighborhood's full of minorities who move around an awful lot. What we're going to do, we're going to send them a letter. We're going to send them some type of correspondence. And if it comes back to us as undelivered, we're going to then challenge the vote. Or if they don't respond to the letter the way they're supposed to, then we're going to challenge their vote and we're going to suppress the vote. And the Brennan Center for Justice defines caging this way. Voter caging is a practice of sending mail to addresses on the voter rolls, compiling a list of mail that is returned undelivered and is used to purge or challenge voter registrations on the grounds that the voters on the list do not legally reside at their registered addresses. Again, supporters of voter caging defend the practice as a means of preventing votes cast by ineligible voters. Voter caging, however, is notoriously unreliable. If it is treated unjustifiably as the sole basis for determining that a voter is ineligible or does not live at the address at which he or she is registered, it can lead to unwarranted purge or challenge of eligible voters. Moreover, the Brennan Center writes, the practice has often been targeted at minority voters, making the effects even more pernicious. So they've got these guys from Americans for Prosperity and the Republican Party on tape saying this is what we're going to do. One, the Republican Party of Wisconsin will use its voter vault statewide voter file to compile a list of minority and student voters targeted in Wisconsin communities. Americans for Prosperity will use this list to send mail to these voters indicating the voter must call and confirm their registration information and telling them if they do not call the number provided, they could be removed from the voter list. Now remember, this is Americans for Prosperity doing this. Number three, Tea Party organizations will recruit and place individuals at official poll as poll workers in selected municipalities in order to make able to challenge people at the polls. So you can show up at the polls that day and there would be somebody there waiting for you with your name on a list going, well, when he comes, we're going to challenge him. Because he didn't respond to our letter to make the phone call. He didn't get back to us. And number four, on election day, these organizations will make use of any postcards that are returned as undelivered to challenge voters at the polls. This is what they did in Florida in 2000 when they purged all those people off the voting rolls that they claimed were criminals, were felons. 90,000 people they purged off the rolls without even checking who they were, which is how we got George W. Bush. Now listen, they're doing this stuff in Ohio. They're doing it here in Pennsylvania. They're going to be doing it in Nevada. They're going to be doing it in Colorado. They're going to be doing it in Arizona. So you have got to be aware of this. And I'm telling you, if you get this kind of correspondence, I would complain to the Elections Commission. That's just what I would do. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this to wrap this up. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back. Stick around.
To the Rick Smith Show.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have Mark Warren, author of Fire in the Heart, How White Activists Embrace Racial Justice. Also, we're going to be talking with Ryan Sanders, congressional candidate in the 19th Congressional District, running against Todd Platts. And also, we're going to talk with Andy over at the Trade Commission there about their press release and what we should be doing, Andy Gussert, about what we should be doing with Korea and this bizarre trade policy that we seem to be in love with, these really, really bizarre trade policies. One of the last stories I wanted to get to tonight, Pastor Ted. Remember Pastor Ted, the guy who said, I think I know what you did last night. And, you know, one of the big anti-gay activists who, you know, was out there fighting for legislation to make, you know, homosexual illegal, to go out there and push that one man, one woman thing. until we found out that he was, you know, sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker, and then his church kind of just walked away from him and said, you know, sorry, Ted. Goodbye. In a good Christian way, though. They did that in a good Christian way, of course. They turned their backs on the guy that they had idolized for years and years. And I also love the guy from, you know, since we're talking about, you know, good conservative Christian values, I love the guy in Florida, Bob Allen, who was a state legislator who said, you know what, I think homosexuals are so bad that we're going to make sex in a park a crime, a felony. So if you approach somebody in the bathroom and like Larry Craig did in the Minneapolis airport, we're going to make that a felony and you're going to go to jail. So Bob Allen's walking through the park one day. I don't really know if it was the month of May or not, but he's walking. It started to rain, and he ran into a men's room, and there was a very large black man, very large black man. And he was so afraid that he offered to pay the very large black man to have sex with him. There's no punchline. That's it. Bizarre stuff. But anyway, the two of them may actually have a new roommate, because the bishop, Eddie Long, the Christian author, gospel singer, and leader of one of the nation's best-known black megachurches, the Associated Press is reporting, and a guy who finds a wide audience for his marriage is between one man and one woman nonsense. Well, the reality is marriage may be between one man and one woman, but hanky-panky with Spanky on the down low seems to be okay for the good pastor. There are accusations that the TV preacher, a married father of four, used jewelry, cars, and cash to lure three young men into sexual relationships. Lawsuits filed Tuesday and Wednesday say the young men were 17 or 18 years old at the time, enrolled in New Birth Missionary Baptist Church's Ministry for Teen Boys. I'm guessing that's the New Catholic Church, if this is right. A lawyer for Long, who writes books on heterosexual relationships and has strong ties to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s family, adamantly denies allegations. Here's my advice. Stick to that, brother. The minions, they're never going to believe the charges, and the cash will just keep flowing in, and you'll make big money because this is a massive church. I'm telling you, if you admit it, take a look at Pastor Ted. Pastor Ted is the person you should be consulting now, because you will surely see the light at the end of the street where no one will talk to you, and you're eating out of dumpsters like Limbaugh says homeless people and hungry people should do. And especially since this is a black preacher, the black community, they frown upon the going on the down low there. Anyway, B.J. Bernstein, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, said she opened her investigation after getting a call from one of the men. The Associated Press normally does not print people's names, but the lawyer said that the victims were okay with it. I'm not going to say what their names are. Bernstein said she didn't trust local authorities to investigate the claims. Her statement was, this is a really large church that is incredibly politically powerful. There are pictures of this guy with every politician around with something this important. I cannot trust that word didn't get back to the bishop. DeKalb County Sheriff Thomas Brown, who has been a member of the New Birth Baptist Church for more than 15 years and sits on the advisory board for Longfellow's Youth Academy, he said he would stand by the bishop and bristled at Bernstein's suggestions that local authorities couldn't be trusted. He said, quote, I take offense to that. It does not merit a dignified response. Look, I mean, come on. The guy sits on the board. Yeah, do you really think he's going to diligently dive into this stuff, something that could really take this church down? I don't think so. Bernstein said her case hinges on her three clients' testimony and that she doesn't have much physical evidence backing up her complaints. Bishop sent dozens of emails and phone calls to her clients, though they weren't overtly sexual, she said. Bernstein said she plans to subpoena records from Long that will show he traveled with the young men to New York, Las Vegas, New Zealand, and elsewhere. And you might remember this place. George W. Bush and three former presidents visited the sprawling New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta for the 2006 funeral of Coretta Scott King. You remember she's the widow of Martin Luther King Jr. Introduced speakers and the Reverend Bernice King, and of course that's King's younger daughter, who is also a pastor at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church. This is a massive place. They claim members of athletes, politicians, entertainers, you name it. These people are there. They've got 25,000 members over a 250-acre estate there, a $50 million, 10,000-seat cathedral, and more than 40 ministries. This, to me, is big business. And it seems it could be crumbling down because you've got a guy who allegedly is a hypocrite. And the reason I bring this up is because too often we keep seeing the people who are the loudest voices against allowing people to be who they are doing exactly the same thing. And I think part of it is they're ashamed of themselves. There's this self-loathing. I can't think of anything else. I mean, what would make you do something like that? What would make you do it? I remember growing up in the Catholic Church, and we always knew that there were a couple of interesting priests around. Where I went to church, it was one of the poorest dioceses in the city of Cleveland. It was a swinging door on our parish, where all of the priests who had problems, that's where they came to. They came to our parish to be sent somewhere else. And everybody knew that, half the people coming in had problems. And here we are 30 years later still talking about this, and the church has done very little to clean it up. And you've got people like this guy who we've put so much faith in, maybe too much faith, 25,000 people in a church. A mega church. I mean, maybe I'm missing it. I'm sure it's profitable. But what do we do with people like this? What should we do? Who've betrayed our trust? I mean, part of me says, now he can be who he was born to be. But there's a part of me that's angry at all the pain and the suffering and all of the hatred that this guy spewed. Kind of makes you angry. I know it makes me. Anyway, tomorrow on the program, a lot to talk about. The Republicans are going to unveil their pledge to America, the new Republican agenda. It's not the contract to destroy America. It's probably much worse. Some of the early stuff coming out is that they're going to, we're going to stop job-killing high taxes. Well, explain me how we're going to do that. We're going to require congressional approval for all new federal regulations. Okay, I thought we already did that. They're going to repeal and replace health care. What are you going to replace it with? Oh, yeah, pay or die. Yeah, I get it. Sure. We're going to roll back non-discretionary spending to 2008 levels before TARP and stimulus. So basically they're going to cut all of the programs that have saved the economy from completely collapsing. Now remember, when we're talking about this stuff, these are people's lives. When we're talking about cutting unemployment benefits, because this is what some of this money did. It propped up our economy so that the people at the bottom, the people at the margin, didn't have to suffer so much. That's what we did. And they want to take that away. They want people at the margins to suffer. At a time, it infuriates me, and I talked about it at the beginning of the program. We got a handful of people who are doing really well. The billionaire class is back. They're fat and happy. They got extra cheese on their Whopper. They don't have to eat generic food, the generic brands anymore. They don't have to worry about their home being foreclosed on or losing their health care. So again, I go back to the old labor saying, which side are you on? Are you on the side of the billionaire class? Or are you on the side of the working class? We can have our differences, brother, But we got to come together for what's important. And what's important is how we feed our kids, how we ensure our lives, and how we have a secure retirement in our old age. That's it. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.